I'm going to make a recording of this, so we should have another applause. No, I'm just kidding. Yay!
Yay!
Yeah! All right, so we're going here? Yes.
Okay, good.
All right, what are we talking about? Okay. By the way, I've been doing astrology since I was 14 when Uranus crossed my ascendant. And in Boulder, Colorado. And I found out that Catherine had the same thing. I'm staying with her. She's like, Uranus crossed my ascendant at 14 as well. So we both got awakened to cosmic consciousness at that age. And so I've been doing this for a long time. And my progressed moon is crossing my ascendant on Sunday. And it was actually crossing my progressed moon when I began learning astrology. So it's like a return of sorts. And I just slid down my Neptune-Jupiter line. It goes right through Boulder. And it goes right through Tucson. So Jupiter, Neptune, Mars are in my 12th. And they come to my ascendant here. So I've always wanted to come to Tucson to explore the Jupiter-Neptune desert version.
You brought Colorado weather.
Yes, brought some cold weather.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. But anyway, this is mythic themes and aspects. I really originally called it mythic aspects, because that's the new technique. But somebody wanted me to include mythic themes, so I threw that in too. And this is just the solar system. So it's nice to have that showing at the beginning. To kind of get a feel for what we're dealing with here on the personal, social, and transcendent level of consciousness. I kind of like put Pluto up here because it's like, you know, a series, but got promoted to dwarf planet, so I put Pluto up here, you know. So these are kind of like little portal points, you know. Actually, Mercury's a portal point, too. I mean, Mercury's the first planet where the spiritual light of the sun has to go through Mercury before it gets to any of us. So it's almost like Mercury's the beam guy that beams the essence of spiritual illumination as. So when I was having dreams, I learned a lot through dreams, having Jupiter, Neptune in the 12th house. This thing here popped into my dreams, and it was like glowing in a big circle. I thought I was on Lord of the Rings or something. So it's not the Kabbalah. People go, is that the Kabbalah? I'm like, no, it's not the Kabbalah. It's just, you know, here's the Earth right there, which is the ascendant. There's the ascendant right there. And the moon and sun. And then you can see how Mercury, why they call Mercury the Lord of portals, you know. Ancient times they'd always say a prayer before walking into a building, you know, to Hermes, because you were going into a portal and you wanted that building to be safe. So Mr. Merchant here, Mercury is the god of thieves and merchants. So, you know, Mercado, merchandise, mercurial. He connects us to all these other portals. But Ceres is pretty important too. It sits at a beautiful position in where Bode's law in astronomy says there should be a planet. And there was a planet. And actually, Ceres is actually a very nice spherical world, too. It's not like an asteroid, just a rock. It's achieved spherical status and has a nice 4.6-year orbit. And so a lot of myths have to do with Demeter and her relationship with Pluto. So we're going to go into that. And we have Jupiter-Saturn, the nice polarity there. I call this the cultural establishment polarity. Every 20 years, Jupiter and Saturn get together, and they form a wave through history. Every 800 years, they do 200 years in the fire signs, 200 years in the earth, 200 years in the air signs, which we're going back to in 2020, full on. We had one conjunction in Libra, of course. Look what happened. Look how mental the world got. We had the internet at the midpoint. So this cycle brings back renaissances on the planet, where there's like intellectual awakenings, and we all need this world, needs a little bit of that awakening going on. Actually, the Greeks invented astrology during an air wave. The Libra conjunction that brought us the internet brought the Greek Socrates. He was born under that conjunction. Mm-hmm. And then they had an 80-year transition period between Earth and air sign. We only had a 40-year period. So those guys, by the time Alexander goes all the way to India, you have a situation where they invented the great library with the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction in Gemini. Let's get a lot of books and put them in this. And then, of course, Chiron has this beautiful position here as the awakener to these outer planets, divine mind, divine heart and love, and divine will. You know, so these outer planets are, I don't really use the modern rulerships, just because I've gone back to the traditional. I've seen too many charts with Scorpio rising and Mars describes them exactly like they act, you know. I have three clients with Scorpio rising, and they all have Mars and Leo in the ninth house, and they're all like clowns and creative and sunny. I mean, they got that deep, dark, mysterious sort of Scorpio rising look right into your soul with their herbalist eyes. But they're always, like, very happy and sunny. I'm like, wow, the ancient planets are alive and kicking. So we're going to be looking at some of these, because when you get these planets, especially just the traditional seven, because that's what the ancients didn't have any of this down here. And so they had all these great stories that we read about, but they didn't have Pluto to tell you about those stories. How did they tell those stories? How do they talk about, you know, all these themes like Artemis and Apollo, and you know they had this beautiful connection with these planets. So I worked that out. You know, I actually mentioned it to Demetra George one time, and she was like, "Wow, that's great." I was like, "So yeah, so we're going to introduce that technique today." I kind of have this idea that, you know, the archetypes are kind of like the software coming down from the core. I call it the core conscious instead of the unconscious. When we call it the unconscious, you're saying that it's unconscious. and it's really conscious down there. I mean, we're unconscious of it. That's from our perspective. But it is the core and the source of consciousness. So we got this psyche that interfaces with this body, so this hardware, and these instincts. You know, you got mating instincts, you got death instincts, you got rooting instincts, nesting instincts. Even birds know how to build a nest. So according to Jung, the instincts and the archetypes are the correlates to the instincts. So each archetype was defined as emotionally charged imagery coming from the center. And the archetype was the sort of expression of the instinct in the realm of the mind, the emotion, and the mythic realms. You got five dimensions of human experience. I like to use the hand model, you know, talk to the hand. You get the I like this here being the physical dimension. It's like the smallest, you know, but we think it's like big according to modern science. That's it, you know. But we got this mind, the cognitive realm. Then this emotional realm. Look how big the emotional realm is, you know, compared to everything else. And then you got this mythic realm of dreams and archetypes and stories that are transcultural. And then you got the spiritual realm, which is like plugging into the source, the one. You got one thumb. That's the one. You know? So I like to see this as the elements. Like fire would actually not be spirit, because spirit is undifferentiated unity consciousness. You can't be fire. That's something. So fire is actually the realm of the archetypes, you know, the mythic visions, which would correspond to the plasma state of matter. Then you got the water state, and then, you know, the liquid, the gas, and of course the earth or solid. So really, all these levels are connected. And any time an archetype manifests, it's going to manifest at many of these levels. And, you know, we can sit back and make predictions and go, oh, look, here comes Pluto to your Venus. How's your relationship, emotional life? You know? But really, I like to take the other approach and be like, yes, Pluto's coming to your Venus, but what do you want to do with it? You have options here. You can express it on the physical level. The mental level, you can write dark gothic poetry if you want. You know, there's an emotional level, you can go through an emotional rebirth. There's an archetypal level, you can enact the myth of Persephone. It might not be fun, but you know, going down the underworld, you'll get wise. And there's a spiritual expression. So what I like to do is like, I like to journal transits with clients. Be like, all right, here comes this big transit. This is the big one this year, right here in January. So what do you want to do with it? You know, let's get creative with it. Let's mythically tell a story. And invite you into the, so you're not just getting kicked along by planets, you know. You actually can, as Joseph Campbell called it, have a participation mystique, a mystical participation with the archetypes. Because when you start participating with them, they start participating with us in greater ways that change everything. The whole game changes it. And then we have memory rings, where we store things. I call this the death consciousness. So we think of consciousness as a sphere. You have the core, the middle of the sphere. And you got this sort of the interior being like tree rings being storing up. Every year when our sun comes back to our sun on the solar return on your birthday, you're having another ring of experience being stored, like a tree ring. Going right on out, yeah. And what happens is when you have an experience out here, it goes inward and gets stored at the current developing ring, just like a tree. Except ours are in our consciousness. I mean, we have layers too. You know, I got cancer because I was too worried. No. But we have our own physical layers, but the body is like the outer part of the tree, the bark. You know, so we'll get to that. But this is a kind of a new theory of consciousness that I'm bringing in here, and I got it by meditating on a river in Asheville, surrounded by trees, and I had a vision of trees, and I was like, wow, the inner layers of trees are like consciousness. So we're going to talk about that. And it's all fun. So anyway, the sacred craft of astrology, and it is a craft. People say it's a language. Astrology is a language. And it is a language. It uses language. But it's really a combo of all these. We use mathematics. The ancient astrologers were called mathematici, because they had to know trigonometry and geometry to figure out what planets were. We use mythology. Kepler called astrology celestial physics. I was a physics major, you know. And I told him I wanted to be an astrologer, and they said, you can't. I said, you want to bet? My Aquarius son said, we'll see. but they always wanted to focus on just the physical world, you know, matter. And I was like, wow, science is so precise, but it's always trying to eliminate consciousness from the equation. And consciousness doesn't want to leave the equation. So, but physics comes from the Greek word physis, which means to the endeavor of seeking the true nature of all things. So, celestial physics is the endeavor of seeking the true nature of all things through the inspiration of the cosmos. So that's a great name. You can see why Kepler called astrology celestial physics. And of course, social studies. We study history. We study geography, especially now with astrophotography. We study cultures and how they evolve through time. We have depth psychology. We have storytelling and counseling. I mean, we do a lot as astrologers. I mean, you got to be smart to be in this profession, you know? And so that's kind of like, so I'm kind of, you know, advocate for this, as you know, because it's a craft. You have to actually sit down and create a chart. Well, the computer program does now, but so part of the thing is there's some guidelines. I like to start out with a poetic statement, you know. Someone has like the sun in Scorpio in the fifth house, I'll be like, ah, you walk the path of the alchemist in the field of creativity. You know, it's just a nice little intro. Bring it in poetic, because when you evoke the poetic imagery, that's when the chart starts dancing. I've actually, in the middle of a session, like, heard music start to play all around. Oh! Mars will go boom, 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 boom. He's just like, ding! You know? I'm like, what's happening? And it was like, I actually tapped into what Kepler described as the music of the spheres, and it was like, so beautiful. And so, that's why I like to bring in that poetic statement. But it's really easy to do that up front, because that kind of gets the myths moving. The myths want to access us, and we want to access them. That's where all the transformations are going to happen. Because when people start comparing themselves to these myths, it's not like they have to live out the myths, but there'll be elements of the myths. Myths are like DNA. They have like replicating features. They can replicate on the physical level, mental level, emotional, archetypal, and spiritual level. And you'll have these experiences that relate to the myth. I really love the elements and modes in my work, because when you put the four elements with the three modes, you get the 12 signs, right? But when I like to think of the modes as cardinals being outward moving energy, like yang. And then the inward is fixed, you know, yin. And then the spiral would be the combo, the yin and yang flowing together. So you can actually create like your own Tai Chi and be like, Aries, outward moving fire. Taurus, inward moving earth. Gemini, spiral air. You know? You can like dance the zodiac. You know? This is really fun to do. You know? And then of course there's qualities and dignities. We don't give a lot of attention to the qualities. I do in my work because my new book that I've been writing for 12 years, it's coming out in 3 months. So I didn't bring any tonight because it's not done yet. I don't want to bring you an incomplete book. You'd be missing some chapters and be like, hey. but the qualities are essential to the Tao astrology. Tao means the way. The acts of character means movement through atama. Atama and iku, which is basically movement through intelligent motion. So it's like how to flow, how to go with the flow, you know? In the way. So the way of astrology, the Tao of astrology is the book. And I do a lot with the qualities, you know. For instance, we always read that Jupiter's the planet of opportunity. But when you look at the qualities, you can see that, oh, Jupiter is hot and moist. So it's inclusive, it likes to make connections, and it likes to raise the energy and the frequency of events happening. That's why Jupiter's the planet of opportunity, because its alchemical quality is like, it comes along and it raises the energy and brings more inclusivity and opportunity to connect. Where Saturn does the opposite. Saturn's like, cold and dry. Yeah. Saturn's like, I'm going to break connections and go off on my own and be alone. And then I'm going to, like, you know, lower the energy, you know, go into the cold. So when you think of hot-cold axis, think not in terms of temperature, but in terms of kinetic energy. Cold is like rest state, like the moon. The moon is very cold. The sun is very, like, out there shining bright, so it's very hot kinetic. So all the fiery planets, Mars, Jupiter, Sun, they're all hot. And inclusive planets that are on the wet, moist side, they like to mix things. Like Venus is ultimate. The ancients put her right on the line because she could be cold or hot, but she's right on the line. She's the maximum power of like synthesis and bringing things together. So we'll look at that too. Dignities are important because if you can follow the sponsorship trails in the chart, you get this whole other chart behind the chart. And is anybody familiar with chart patterns? Mark Evan Jones? Well, it turns out that if you just look at the seven traditional planets, I've been looking at chart patterns with the seven traditional planets, and it turns out that if you look at just the seven traditional planets, to get to know the person, we call them the personal planets. I like to get to know the person before I put all their angels in. So when you do that, you actually only get six chart patterns because the locomotive goes by, it gets folded in with the bolt. There's not nine planets that have spread over 10 houses. So when you do that, you get six of these beautiful patterns, and each of these patterns relates to one of the archetypal polarities. For instance, the seesaw is Aries Libra. It's, when people have that, they have in their basic psychological makeup this constant flow between these two sides of the chart, you know? So Aries Libra, Aries is the archetype of courage through heroism, and Libra is about harmony through resonance, grace. So I call that axis the axis of courageous grace. You know, so Taurus and Scorpio is serene transformation. You know, Gemini and Sag is spontaneous inspiration. Watch out. Cancer and Capricorn is hearth wisdom. You know, and Leo and Aquarius is creative communion. What we're doing right now, groups gather together, creative communions. You know, and of course Virgo Pisces, devotion, Virgo to spirit or visionary arts. You know, so visionary devotion or spiritual devotion. So, for instance, if you look at in one section in the book, it talks about each of these patterns and what they're like. And what, like, for instance, the bucket pattern is about Virgo Pisces. It's about spiritual devotion. It's the handle. Everything's like, oh, yeah, we're devoted to this. And you can actually bear this out and look at people's charts and go like, oh, well, Da Vinci. Da Vinci had a bucket chart, just the seven traditional planets. Now, I always figure the element balance, too, with just the seven traditional planets. Because then you actually get to know the person on the ground level, instead of just the equations get thrown out when you put all the generational planets in. It's really cool because you can get like this beautiful elemental portrait of their being. But the Da Vinci has Saturn in the midheaven in Libra, and it was a bull. So here's this guy who spent his life being a master, Saturn, of art, Libra, in the vocation house, and all these planets down here are like totally aiming their talents to help that spiritual devotion happen. So it's really interesting, you know. The display is definitely creative communion, Leo Aquarius. The Sagittarius Gemini pattern would be the splash, everything's everywhere. Got a lot of things going on, you know. And then when you have a bundle, everything's just real focused and tight within like four signs or three, within 9 degrees. You have that's the serene transformation. That's the Taurus Scorpio. They're like really trying to harness that power, you know. And it actually acts like a monarchy, you know. Whereas, like, someone who has, like, a mutual reception between two planets, it starts to act like a republic. You get, like, this Senate thing going on. Let's check in over here. And they actually act like that. It's really amazing to watch how people do this. So these are those levels, again, spiritual principle. Every archetype has a spiritual principle. I like to say that the rising sign shows your PhD in terms of its spiritual principle in this life. So, like, I'm Sag rising, so I'd say, Kelly, your PhD is faith through divine inspiration. You know, if someone had Capricorn rising, you might say, your PhD in life is ambition through integrity. You know, so the archetypal imagery is where the myth comes in. And that's the focus tonight, is at this level. There's all these other beautiful levels we'll look into, especially tomorrow at the workshop. Because every sign has an emotional expression, a mental, cognitive state. Like, you wouldn't think of Taurus as being like a very cognitive sign. But when you take Taurus as a mental concept, it's the concept of reverence. You know, when you're standing in the forest and you're smelling the trees, you're like, ah, oh, reverence. That's Taurus as a cognitive state. You know, Scorpio would be impermanence. You know, so whenever I see someone going through a strong plutonic or scorpionic, you know, their progressed moons in Scorpio, I tell them, the Zen Master Suzuki said, we don't need to learn how to let things go. We just need to recognize when they're already gone. So, but Scorpio as an emotion would actually be the emotion of intrigue. You know, so the emotional states that I connect with each sign, you have to be able to feel them, you know. Like, I feel intrigued. That's what Scorpio is about. Of course, they have shadow sides. Like Aries is motivation. So, you know, and it can be dampened, and it can be amplified. So Aries at the damper state, or dampened state, is just like moved, being moved. I feel moved. Like that movie moved me. You know? And then motivation. When you're motivated, you're motivated. And then that kind of turns into passion at the highest level of the archetypal emotion. So then you have like the shadow side. What's the shadow side of motivation? Anger. So, you know, starts off as frustration down here and annoyance, builds into anger, and then rage, you know? Where you're like throwing dishes at the wall or something. You're just like, ah, you know? So you have all these different emotional expressions. The alchemy comes in when you start to blend with other signs. Because every sign has an emotional quality, like Aquarius, excitement, you know? Sagittarius, enthusiasm. Gemini is the emotion of interest. I feel interested. You know? Starts off as curiosity, like, I'm curious. Yeah. I'm interested. And then it comes into total absorption, total mental absorption. That's the highest amplified state. But when you mix them, it's beautiful. Like, you got a planet in Aries, a planet in Libra. They're facing off in the sign and signs of courageous grace. The emotional states are motivation and harmony and peace. I feel peaceful. I feel, you know. But the shadow side of Libra is despondency, like sadness. Like, nobody likes me. You know? And then over here you got Aries, which is like motivation but anger. So you start to get anger, and you start to get despondency. Those two emotions turn into resentment. So you can actually feel like these intense emotional states that turn into like these globs in your consciousness. So they turn into knots in the wood analogy. And when the emotional wave comes forth from the center, it plays upon those knots. And you're like, why am I so bitter? So those are some of the areas we can express this stuff. Others. We can express it, of course, the houses. I love the houses. I use the porphyry house system just because I like trisecting my quadrants. Only takes 15 minutes to do a chart by hand. No, I need any tables except for just figuring out the ascended midheaven and go. And I like trisecting the quadrants just because I like the houses as fields of experience, space, spatial zones. So, and plus Porphyry was this cool vegetarian monk from like 200 AD who like wrote down all of Plotinus' writings in the Enneads, and he was a vegetarian. I'm a vegan, so I'm like, cool, you're my homie. But but anyway, so, you know, every health system works in its own way, according to its own logic. You just got to pick the one that works for you. But what I like about the houses is that the only agreement between the ancient Hellenistic astrologers and ours in terms of the signs and the houses, is they didn't call the first house the house of Aries. They said it was the house of the body. You know? And so, but they all agreed across the board, no conflict on what body part goes with that. The areas of like the first house, the head and the face, and you know, the neck, Taurus. So Taurus, the sign governed the neck, and so did the second house. 12th house was the feet. Pisces was the feet. So they had complete agreement in terms of their actual physical expression in the body, which is what lives there? The instincts. All of our instincts live in our body. You know? If you gotta go to the bathroom, you can try to ignore it a little bit with your volition with Mars. You're like, I'm going to hold it. But see how it works out in the long run. So the body has its own wisdom, you know. I mean, a pregnant woman makes a baby. And she doesn't have to wake up and say, I'm going to put the arm on today. It just happens. So that's the wisdom of the Tao, of nature. I was in a philosophy group in Boulder, and I started talking about the consciousness of nature. These guys are all like rational empiricists and trained in the university. Right? They're like, nature doesn't have any consciousness. And I looked at him and said, do you believe in evolution? He's like, of course I believe in evolution. It's like, well, he was pretty conscious enough to create you so you could have that thought. Anyway, I always argue with the rationalists. But yeah, so aspects, we're going to be looking at those. That's the beauty of the chart. And evolutions, in the new book, I'm just calling all movements of the charts evolutions. Whether you're doing solar arcs, progressions, whatever you're doing. Transits, the chart's evolving, right? So, evolutions. And then, of course, sinistry. So you got all these different layers. Those are all the layers you could talk about. I always want to know, like, what are all of my options here? What I could talk about. So this here, just to give you an idea of this new theory of consciousness, which really should excite astrologers, is this is like a tree, right? In the center of the tree, they call it the pith. It's like the liver. It sends energy up and down. It has these medullary rays that are like mercury communicating with everything. And this heart wood around the middle is like the oldest wood, you know? And that's where the beginning of the tree began growing out, one ring per year. So when the sun comes back to the sun every year of your chart, you've just added another layer to your inner experience. And so everything's recorded, you know? And then, of course, you've got this area here, this white area here, which is, we call that the, in biology, that's called the xylem. And the xylem is connected to the bottom of the tree through the roots. It's almost like the motions of the tree come up from the mineral waters from the deep underworld. And then what they do is they meet at this layer of cells, one layer thick right here, called the cambium. And this right here, this section is called the phloem. And the phloem is like the mind of the tree. It's the part that's connected to the sky and the heavens and photosynthesis and bringing energy and sugars into the tree. And they meet right here at this layer. And they create new cells right there. They then go out and become new buds for new branches, like new branches of possibility. You know? And of course, the bark is the outer physical that you can touch. So in the analogy, the pith would be the spiritual center. The heartwood would be the archetypal, like the chart in your consciousness. This xylem would be like your emotional field. The phloem would be like the mind, you know. And of course, there's the bark, which is the body. So the instincts are out here, and there's emotions coming up like in waves, and they're mixing with it. You know, if something hits you out here or touches you, it's a sensation. You have emotions, sensations, you have thoughts. You also have intuitions. Intuitions are thought impulses that are able to go right to the source and ascertain what's happening deep down. So intuitions are archetypal feelings. And that's what you need to cultivate to think mythically. Because you're basically like getting, when you're doing a chart and everything's flowing and combining and everything, and you got your basic knowledge, you know. Mercury is the intellect. You know, and then you got your structure, how are you laying it out for the client? And that's very logical stuff. Then comes Neptune, the blending of it all in the imaginary and mythic realms. And then when you start doing that, that's when Uranus goes zap, and you get these like these moments of where you just feel like you need to say this to the client. That's exactly what they need to hear. Because you're getting you got your archetypal feeling engaged. So archetypes manifest as the correlates to the instincts. And the instincts are in the body. You have a mating instinct, you have a rooting instinct, you have will to survive. That would be like Aries. tribal instinct. We're all gathered here. Why are we gathered here? There's an instinct to get together, fellowship. So every house, and it turns out, when I mapped out, I studied like 5,000, because the animal kingdom has 5,000 different instincts, or more, depending on the study, you know. And when I classified them all by the houses or the signs, I was just doing it by the signs. Turns out at the end of my study, I looked at it, and all the meanings were the same as the houses. I was like, wow! So the instincts really like live in the house expression. And the word archetypoon means, arcane means original governing. Archis means to govern. So it's the original, arcane, like archaeology, studying the ancients. Typhoon was the Greek to make a cast, like imprint something in flesh or metal. So it's the original governing. Oh, and it's related to the Latin imago. So the original governing image imprints that puts forth your li, which in Chinese, the character for li is this one right here, which basically, this right here is like a jewel, and this is like cracks in the jade. That's what it literally means. So everybody has their own organic patterning, you know, the wood grain patterns in wood. Everything in nature has a pattern. Well, the astrology chart shows our Li, you know. It shows how we're archetypally patterned. So when you're doing a chart, the essence of is getting down to describing this cracks in the jade for that individual such that they're really inspired to live the highest truth of that, you know. And on all these levels, experiential, mental, emotional, archetypal, and spiritual. So that's kind of where I'm going with this. Yeah, so this came to me in the middle of sitting on a river and sitting on a rock meditating, and next thing you know, I had a tree going through me. So this right here is what I was saying about the qualities. I just like to bring this up. A lot of people aren't so familiar with them, but you want to see here, like winter is like very cold. It's cold outside right now. And in spring, it's very moist. It's a metaphor. Obviously, in the southern hemisphere, it's pretty hot down there. That's because the way archetypes polarize over a globe, everything in the universe is polarity. Once the unified divine being, which I symbolize that way, divides into the rhythmic flow of yin and yang, it gives birth to, I use this symbol, metaphysical symbol for light with a circle around it to symbolize the creative void, which is the root dimension of eternity. That eternity pours through to create all dimensions. So this 1-2-3 process is like right at the core of the universe. And when everything polarizes, I always walked around thinking about, what is God divided by two? For like 20 years, you know? And then one time I was in a coffee shop, and I had my, like, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, like, moment, where I was like, 42! And I realized this equation, you know, that eternal being dissolved into rhythmic vibration gives rise to the root dimension of the creative void. And that's where we go when we use our imaginations. We have to tap into this to be able to do mythic astrology at a really beautiful level. Because the myths contain the wisdom, the story. In the old days, if you had a problem in life, you went to an elder. And you'd say, hey, I'm having this problem. And the elder would say, I don't know anything about that. But since you're still sitting here, I'll tell you a story. And of course, the story contains all the wisdom that the kid needed. Yeah? So that's what we're doing as archetypal storytellers. We're reminding people of the wisdom that's been passed on from generations, even back to when we were little cells hanging out in the coastlines. Morphing, be like, ugh, I don't like you, I'm going down in person. No. So, molecular biology. But the thing is, turns out the moon is very important to that whole process. In the old ancient world, the moon was really big. It was a lot closer. It's been moving 1 centimeter per year out. And when we discovered astrology, it happened to be at the same size as the sun in the last 2,000 years. So basically, the moon in the old world was very crucial. I think when we go out and find interstellar civilizations, we're going to be like, what? You guys don't have a moon sign? There might not be life on that planet. Because the moon actually acts as the stirrer of life. Because when you get a moon, you get tides. When you get tides, you get all those molecular genetics and DNA getting washed up onto the beach at faster rates, and they're out in the sun going, I gotta survive out here, you know, and so they start activate some genes. And so and meanwhile this is happening on the conscious level, it's consciousness level too. And the moon, it turns out the Earth used to only have a rotation of 8 hours, or it was really fast. The moon's tugged it down. It's like Neptune summoned this thing from the outer from Pluto's realm. Comet, asteroid, the astrophysicists say asteroid came in, hit the Earth, became the moon. It's almost like the sun said, hey, Neptune, it's time for life. Bring it in. Boom! And then suddenly the stir rod happened. And as a result, our day slowed down for the next 24 hours, and we had life happen a lot faster. So it might be that some civilizations might have had life 2 billion years into their flow if they had 3 moon signs. Imagine every 3 moon signs. Oh my God, that's my moon in Aries. This is a beautiful diagram because it basically shows a lot about the myths here, you know. Jupiter, Mr. Philosophy Planet, Mr. Higher Education, is actually the only pure air planet in the air quadrant here. According to Robert Hand, the Greeks and the Babylonian qualities preceded the elements. The elements were born out of the combinations. So water was defined as cold becoming moist. Air was moist becoming hot. Fire was hot becoming dry, and earth was dry becoming cold. So the elements came later. But yeah, Jupiter is the only planet that is purely, because Venus does it too, connective and energizing, you know. So Mars transits, what does it do? Mars heats you up, but it breaks connections. More politically correct, forms distinctions. I am you, and you are me. If you test me, I'll hurt you. No. So look at the symbol, Mars. It's got a shield and a spear. It's like those Greek warriors, you know. Whereas the old symbol for Mars was like that. You know, just the opposite of Venus. Right? And then it kind of got all phallic and turned over on the side. But Venus, Aphrodite carried a hand mirror. It looked just like that. That was her little mirror. And can't be Venus, and mirror. But we all have Venus inside us. And so you get a lot out of this. Uranus would be hot and dry, but to an extreme level. So Uranus would actually be very fiery. It actually acts like that. In the transits, you'll see that Uranus shows up a lot more in traumatic accidents and things than Pluto any day. Pluto doesn't want any quick trauma. It wants a slow, 2-year, painful, fiery, searing, twisting into your heart, you know? Whereas Uranus falls, boom! And you're laying there, what just happened? You know? And of course, Neptune would be like extreme water, you know. So these are, that's what you see here. You know, Neptune is super, super cold, super moist. It's like planet of dreams. I mean, this section, you just kind of go see. And so there's all these beautiful planets here. I put Chiron over here. The ancients didn't know about Chiron. But it turns out Chiron works perfect there, because Venus is the only one that sits on that here. Because Venus can be up here, hot. You can be like, it's a young, beautiful woman at the party. She's like, I'm hot. Or she can polarize with Mars and become the mother, and Mars becomes the father, and then she's holding down this deeper, grounded vibe. Guy's going out drinking, and she's like, who's going to pay the bills? She's all responsible. Now here what's happening. You know, and Saturn, of course, you know, the beautiful imagery is, you know, Saturn is matter over mind. Like, deal with reality first. And Jupiter is mind over matter. We can do anything in one direction. So it's just beautiful to get a reminder there of the qualities and how they tie in. Because if you got Saturn making an aspect to your moon and you're feeling melancholic and depressed, you can kind of understand. You can be like, oh, the moon is moist and cold. Saturn is dry and cold, so Saturn's dryness is canceling the moon's moist, and I feel double cold, frozen heart. You know? So what are you going to do with that? Give an opportunity here. There's a poem by David White called The Well of Grief, where he says, those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small gold coins thrown by those who wish for something else. So I always tell clients, I say, look, you can throw that coin and get your new relationship or your new car, but what about the coin that says, I want a deep relationship with the eternal being that crafted the universe despite any suffering I have to go through? Bring it on! That's the coin I throw. I mean,
that's right.
I love that coin. But yeah, so then you can see, like, Pluto was in the middle, because Mercury was in the middle. According to the ancients, Mercury could not carry a message, or it would be a bad messenger. It had to be neutral in the middle. Although it kind of cheated and went Earth and air with its Virgo Gemini. But in general, Mercury has a neutral charge, because it can send you can get a message of energize, let's go, or rest, retreat, go inward, or connection, I like you, I hate you, separate. You know, Mercury can go either way. Turns out Pluto would be under Mercury, inside the board, like over here. So Pluto's in the underworld. Pluto does the same function as Mercury. It takes the message, passes it on, but it transforms it first. And usually it's to its opposite. It's the alchemist, you know, transforming the lead of the lower self with the gold of the higher self. That's why Pluto looks like a little guy with his arms are going, I surrender! render means to melt, and sir means to the highest, like riding the surf. So rendering to the sir means melting to the highest, aligning your will with the divine will. Which is really what Pluto was. If you just give him the program day one, you won't have to go through so much pain. You're like, all right, what do you want out of me, divine? Okay. Ceres is beautiful. The four elements, right, the cross of matter, and the consciousness, the arc of consciousness, the consciousness rising out of the four elements. This is Demeter. This is the earth goddess. And she would be above Mercury, outside of Earth. She was called the bringer of seasons by Homer. And Ceres could do all four. Actually, whatever season you were born in, Ceres acts like that quality. And whatever season you're in, Ceres transits will act like that quality. So Ceres will act like very hot if it's summer. Born in the summer. I was born in February 5th, so I'm winter birth, so Ceres in my chart is very cold and goes inward and retreats and rests. And it's in my fifth house, so I go and write for like 8 hours. I don't even know what time went by. But yeah, so basically, that's the qualities, and it's good to get those in your head if you're going on a mythic journey here. Because so the big question is, how can mythic stories help people? I like being practical too. I got Mercury in Capricorn. Yeah, is your reading helpful? So you ask clients. They go, "Oh my God, blah blah blah." I'm like, was it helpful? You know, the astrological chart is a mirror to the depths of consciousness. The chart helps them discover their inborn mythic resonance. I call it their wu wei of being. Wu wei is the Chinese term for actionless action or graceful action. Because when someone can really express all the parts of the chart, they're in this state of like wu wei, graceful action. They're not struggling. So there are mythic threads through, you know, sign, planets, houses, aspects. Image bridges, I like to call, like, if you have, you know, a planet governing your seventh house. Let's say you got Gemini over here. So Mercury, let's say Mercury's up in Libra in the 10th house. So you got this situation where there's an image bridge created between these two houses due to Mercury's dispositorship over this sign. Of course, it's going to bring some 9th house too, from Virgo. So the 9th and the 7th would be connected to the 10th. So that's what I call an image bridge. So there's a lot of imagery flowing between those houses through the dispositorship trip. Because dispositorship comes from the Latin disponere, which means you take energy from here and put it over there. So that's what that's the chart behind the chart. When you can understand those dispositorship patterns, it's pretty powerful. Insight is the ability that we have to tap into the secret life of the archetypes. I mean, we're insighting when we're doing a chart. We're going in. Sometimes I tell class, ready to go in? You ready? All right, let's go.
Dive.
Dive right in, yeah. And so, intuitions are the archetypal feelings of the emergence. And really, the science of emergence is really cool for astrology. This new science, it's about when parts add up to wholes, you know. That's what emergence is about. Emergence is when you can have, when all the parts mix together in such a way that the new thing that emerges cannot be traced back to the parts. Like water. Water is H2O, hydrogen, oxygen. Well, guess what? Those are both gases. How did they become a liquid? And how is the emergent property life? You know, that's what emergence is. Like the Beatles, those four guys got together and they did something pretty magical. And they all broke up and they tried to do it individually. They couldn't get back to what they did because the emergence wasn't there. You needed all four of them together. So emergence is what we're doing in astrology. It's really what we're really doing. We're looking at the chart and saying, you're not your Venus or your Mars or your this or your that. You're the emergent property of all these connections. As a real you, you know. That's why I like to, like, blend things, you know, and bring together, like, the sun, moon, and ascendant, you know. So, someone had, like, what's your moon sign?
I'm sorry?
What's your moon?
Basically, Scorpio.
Scorpio, okay. And what's your sun sign?
Libra.
And what's your rising?
Scorpio.
Oh. Look at that.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I say you have the soul of the alchemist walking the path of the artist, Libra, diplomat, peacemaker, embodying the archetype of the researcher, detective, going down into the depths of transformation and rebirth.
Yeah!
Well, the moon in the first house. Or is it 12?
12.
Okay, 12. All right. Well, even when the moon is in the rising sign, it's going to have a nurturing quality going out. You know?
Oh,
it's like having Cancer rising. You know? It's like the great mother. Let me protect you. First let me stick you, and then let me heal you. No, I'm kidding. But that's what I mean, it's like blending, you know. And you can do that all the levels, you know. The next triad would be Mercury, Venus, and Mars. And the next triad would be Ceres and Jupiter and Saturn. And you got Chiron, Uranus, Neptune, and then Pluto kind of holds it all together. Pluto kind of mixes with the other three, or the other two outer planets to create the generational life. But there's these four levels, and each one creates a whole other mythic reality. And the deepest one, the Pluto, Uranus, Neptune, actually, whatever mythic essences arise out of the houses they're in, the signs they're in, the aspects they have, they kind of establish your core. Remember at the center of the tree, the pit? Mm-hmm. So the center of the tree, there's like this core thing that might say you're an advocate or a visionary or, you know, some archetypal connection. And that kind of fuels the Jupiter-Saturn cultural level. And that kind of fuels the Venus-Mars artistic, romantic, creative level. And then you got that fueling the basic personality of the sun and the city. So it's kind of cool the way that works. So authentic magic occurs when you begin to answer your unique archetypal nature. The mythic, emotionally charged image is a fractal, a unit of consciousness. So when you have a dream, like an old man comes to you in a dream, and then later in the day you see an old man and you have a great conversation, that's like the fractal. You're just seeing the fractal. I mean, fractal, chaos theory fractals are like where a piece can recreate the whole. I mean, that's progressions, you know. We're looking at a day for a year, you know. Progressions are fractals, you know. So symbolos means to bind together, opposite of diabolos, break apart. So symbolos, that's what we're working with. Compressed multivalent
molecule.
Yes, but we're symbolical. So you are the vessel for the unified celestial orchestra. And then you'll hear the music. La! So quick.
Use the music, Bobby.
I like to think of each planet having a year, like Mars is Scorpio, but also Mars is Aries. in the sense of, like, Mars and Aries, it's his yang sign. That's like the warrior who's, like, aggressive. Battlefield warrior. Whereas Mars and Scorpio is more like mother bear protecting her cubs. Okay. Come a little closer, we'll see what happens. Yeah. So, you know, you can't take Jupiter away from Pisces. I mean, Jupiter used to govern mystical states of consciousness and unity and journeys over the ocean, you know. And of course, people try to put... I'm not taking away the affinity of Uranus to, say, this sign. But Saturn was the classical governor of Aquarius. You can't... Saturn is Kronos, the Time Lord. You can't take the sign that governs the future away from the Time Lord. The past and the future, you know. It's a flow. So the ancients had the sun and moon here. Would Mercury govern the next two? Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. And that system worked for 2,000 years. I think people got a little too excited when they were like, what's the next ruler of this side? We don't need them to be rulers. They don't even care. They're transpersonal forces. They're like, whatever, I don't want to rule anything. I'm going to just come in here and, like, rock your world, you know? I'll show you what I rule. And actually, Jung, according to Jung, the archetypes show up in nature, and they call them psychoid archetypes, which are like space and time. Jupiter would be space, expanse. Saturn, time. So Jupiter, Saturn establishes the space-time continuum. Then we have Mars, energy, and Venus, mass, form, beauty. So the energy mass equals MC equation is right there. The life waves is the stars are projecting light into solar systems. And we're like living light, just moving real fast in a circle. So we look solid. And then what astrology brings to this whole equation that science has totally cut out is the moon and Mercury. There is another thing, it's like a continuum, like the space-time continuum, but it's I call it the stream of archetype consciousness. And that's what archetype consciousness is, what we're doing in astrology. So we need to like bring that to balance the equation. One way I do this is through looking at, that looks a little out of focus. Can we get some focus here? Oh. Maybe that's it. Okay. So, these are each sign. You can see, like, Scorpio, there's the emotion, intrigue. There's the mental state, impermanence. This is the outer is the plot motif. If there's a Scorpio story going on, something's getting transformed. You know? If there's a Sagittarian plot motif, there's a quip. I went through all the plots throughout literature, just like I did with instincts, and I lined them up with all the different signs, and it turns out there's only 12. They all fit into 12 nicely. You've got survival, acquisition, comedy, family, or clan, you know, rivalry, sacrifice, love, transformation, quest, achievement, revolution, and redemption. You know, sometimes you get a movie like Star Wars, and they bring a revolution, and a journey, you know, and a transformation, you know, it's like, whoa. Or, you know, you might get, you know, like Braveheart, you know, you got survival on the battlefield and rivalries of kings, you know. So you got every plot motive you can blend up, love. You got love, Gemini and Libra is like the romantic comedy, you know? Love and comedy going together, you know? So, when you can understand, when you're looking at a planet and a sign and you know its plot motif, and then you see it in aspects of another sign, you can be like, ah, here's a myth that's arising in the story right here, in this person. This is right out of my book, and I have the instincts here. So actualization is the urge to be. A lot of these have a lot of different ones, like survival instinct. Attachment is interesting because, you know, second house, security, grounded, attachment. We think in New Age circles, attachment scene is like, you're so attached. But it's really a beautiful thing. Like, I like this laptop. I want to take it with me. It's fun. You know, it's like, stuff is good. So attachment is a good thing. I mean, it can get crazy, but, you know, same thing with detachment. The instincts, all the instincts of detachment, death being the ultimate, Thanatos, death instinct, I'm letting go now! of course, they call this the house of, you know, planet sign of sexuality and your little orgasm, you know?
I'm letting go now!
Petite Marte, or whatever. So, yeah, so detachment. But you actually, to do research, you actually have to detach yourself from your thoughts to find out something new. If you just go in and look for something that you already know, you're just going to find out what you know in this weird feedback loop. That's what most scientists do. We have a hypothesis. I really want it to go this way. Let's design an experiment to make it go that way. Prove astrology is bullshit. Like, wait, did you actually learn astrology? No, why would we need to do that? So I'm working with these professors up in Boulder, and I'm telling them, like, okay, they're like, we're going to prove to you astrology doesn't work. I'm like, well, I have over 5,000 case studies that show that it is perfectly accurate, and you have zero. And you want to study this? And you don't want to learn it. If you're studying a tree in Amazon, wouldn't you go study the tree? You know? So it's interesting. Gemini is the instinct of exchange. It's not just communication. Communication is just one form of exchange. We're communicating ideas through language and words. But really, it's all back to Mercury. Exchange, trade, flow, you know? So these are really deeply, you can really get, if you apply these meanings to the houses, roots, the fifth house is actually production. The ancient world, nobody created anything. That was the realm of the gods. If you were divinely inspired to come up with metallurgy, the gods gave you that. You didn't create it. It was produced by you. You just followed the recipe. But people weren't actually creative until the Renaissance. Then it was like, oh, Da Vinci. Wow, we can all be creative now. But in the ancient world, it was always about production. That's why the fifth house governs putting on a production. Or reproduction. Make another human being. We need more of us. So I like to use this. The instinct to produce something. It's in us. You know? And to root. Virgo, the sixth house here is discernment. You know? To take things apart. Go, oh, that's good. That's not so good. You know? Whereas the 12th house is integration. This is the emergence axis. Because you got the parts and the whole. So really, the 12th house would be called the house of integration. It's only the house of trouble and disintegration. It's when you go all around the block and you get here, you don't do the integration process. Then it all falls apart and you're left on some faraway island in a prison with a needle stuck in you. You know, dark 12th house. So really, I like to call the 12th house. And I like to refer to houses as fields of life experience. So this would be the field of integration. So I have Jupiter and Saturn as well. So I have the urge to explore Jupiter and the need for enculturation is being expressed through the archetype of Sagittarius, the gypsy traveler philosopher, in the field of integration and dreams. So, and the emotion of Pisces is wonder. You know, amplified to euphoria. Mentally, Pisces would be vision. Just when you have visions. Like Aquarius is innovation as a cognitive state, and excitement as an emotion. You know? And what you see around the outside here, since we're getting back to myths, you see Kronos. Everybody knows Kronos, but who's Iapetus? And who's Oceanus? And Creus? And Theia? And Mnemosyne? And Phobe? And Hyperion? And Rhea? And Semus? And Tethys? And Coeus? Where we get the word coeli from. Well, it turns out, in I had another dream. Hyperion actually came to me in a dream. Said, yo, check me out. And so I was like, alright, I had this dream of the sun rising and I heard this word Hyperion. So I went to Wikipedia and read all about Hyperion. I was like, oh my god, it's totally like Leo. You know, everything about it. He was like the lord of the sun and watcher of the east and all this. And so this guy, basically this Titan force inspired me to look at all these Titans. Turns out that in ancient Greek mythology, before the Olympians took over, there was only 12 Titans. And like, for instance, one of them was named Mnemosyne, where we get the word mnemonics. That's why I put it over here with Gemini, because she was called the Titan who bestowed the power of authority through speech and was the Lady of Remembrance. And she gave birth when Jupiter visited her. And for 9 nights in a row, they gave birth to the 9 Muses, you know. So with Jupiter and Gemini this year, I'm telling my clients, like, Jupiter's a Gemini! Zeus is finished visiting Mnemosyne! Pick 2 muses and go with it! You know? And so, you know, that's one way to use mythic astrology. I'm like, wow, this Mnemosyne force is upon us right now. Jupiter's up there right now, conjunct Aldebaran, which means the follower. Who's he following? The Pleiades, because the Pleiades is right in front of him. And in about 3000 BCE, Pleiades was the Harry's point. That was the rising spring point. My Taurus was actually the spring equinox time when the zodiac was developed. It was codified fully about 1250 AD or BCE. So back then you had Taurus being the spring, Leo was the summer solstice sign, Scorpio was the fall, and a was the winter solstice back then. So those myths, if you go back and study the original Babylonian myths, you realize that Capricorn, why is it this weird sea goat, you know? I mean, the symbol is really cool. You know, Capricorn. My teacher used to tell me when I was 14, like, write this down on a piece of paper, go out in the garden, meditate on it. Come back when you have something good. And I'll be like, I get it. It's the wise elder. Look, it's the hermit going down into the depths to hang out by a tree alone in nature. And then, not just stay there selfishly in the solitude, but come back out into the world and plan his work so he can work his plans so like a mirror it reflects the truth he found in the woods. She's like, good job. So, these symbols are really alive, you know. They're not just, like, lame, you know. They're not just made up. I actually have symbols for the houses in my new book. Because I'm like, man, when I want to write an astrological equation, like Jupiter and Sag in the 12th house, I want to have, this is my symbol for the 12th house. The first house, I have the ascendant. The second house, I have two forms coming together and a receptivity. You know? So I have all these like cool symbols for all the houses. But I think the 7th house one goes,
the Glyphmeister.
Yeah. I'm like, why can't we have symbols for the houses so we can really work at the archetypal level? I think my 8th house one goes, it's something like that. Maybe with a dot there. Yeah, it's a dot. But anyway, so we need symbols for the houses. Because I like writing metaphysical equations, and I don't want just a bunch of numbers. Because really, the numbers are very arbitrary. The reason that's the first house and that's the second house was because when the ancient Greeks saw the different star patterns, actually the decans of Egypt, they said, oh, look, the stars of this sign are coming up first, and then these are coming up second, and then third. It's the only reason they named the houses the numbers. Because what stars were going to rise next. So I'd rather have symbols. That's just me. So in the book, I talk about the Titans and all their things. Like Crius, I was like, wow, Crius, he disappeared. He's a Titan. Titans can go invisible at any moment. No. Crius was actually called the warrior Titan. His symbol was the ram, and his constellation was Aries. I was like, why don't we know this as astrologers? This guy's son was also a great warrior. His name was Pallas. And Athena slew him in the great battle and took his name. When you slew another great general, you got to take their epithet. So that's why Athena is called Pallas Athena, because he stole Crius, his son's name. So when you understand these myths, like Theia of Aether, splendor, sight, and enlightenment, she got together with Hyperion to give birth to the sun and the moon, Selene, and Helios. Those are the Titan forms of the sun and moon, as opposed to the mythic forms of like Artemis and Apollo. The Titan forms are like the Jungian psychoid archetypes, the ancient. And what Theia and Hyperion gave birth to was the sun, the moon, and the rising sun. Because there are three. It was Selene. I mean, there was Helios, Selene, and Eos, E-O-S, which means the dawn. In other words, what's rising in the east, you know. So right there in ancient Greek myth, even before we even have Zeus, we have the sun, moon, and rising sign being a central component to their whole mythology. Right there. So that's kind of cool. You know, you got Rhea, she made the ultimate sacrifice, right? If I put her, you know, and generation, and the queen of earth, and mother of gods. You got Themis. Themis is where we get the word theme from. How different is that? Let's have a theme to the party. She was the lady of counsel, divine order, law, and justice. How was that not Libra? You know, so Themis was the original Titaness of Libran grace, and Tethys was always the sexy Titan, and she was the Titaness of wisdom, deep thought, magic, cunning, and the seas. She was the feminine sea. Oceanus was the masculine sea. These two got together and formed all the 3,000 Oceanids or whatever, which were all like the nymphs and everything, and so. One, which was Metis, which gave birth to Athena, because she was the god, the Titaness of wisdom, skill, and craft. And when she got with Zeus, Zeus heard the prophecy that her children would overtake him. So he swallowed up Metis. And then Metis like, got all raging inside and created a massive headache. And then Hephaestus hit him in the head with his hammer, and Athena burst out. And Metis got free. So, of course, Cronos, you know, we think of Cronos as this wise old man. What a king! Mr. Magoo! No. But Cronos actually was, when you study Greek mythology, Cronos was the youngest of all the Titans. He was the baby Titan. This is where he gets his Aquarius side. Because all the Titans were afraid to take up the adamantine skies and take on Uranus for Gaia. For Rhea to go against that was the next iteration. But when Gaia asked for help, the only one that said, I'll take up the skies was Cronos. The young one, he started the revolution. So really, Cronos has a history here. I mean, he lost the war eventually when he got taken down. He got thrown into the underworld in Tartarus, and they left him with his sky so he could, like, govern agricultural cycles. But he's down there in Tartarus, which is like the hell of hell. But so in the original, he was definitely this guy of Cronos, the harvest revolution in Earth. Coeus, where we get that term, you know, the Coeli. Coeus was the titan of the celestial axis, knowledge, oracles, the north, and the air. That's why we have the Nadir, the Imam Coeli, and the Medium Coeli. Because Coeus is the celestial axis that gives... So us astrologers, we should be like really in love with Coeus, because he gives birth to oracle through celestial axes. And then, of course, Iapetos, we all, as humans, should love him, because he was the grandfather of humanity. His son Prometheus and Epimetheus, they crafted humanity. So Iapetos was the god of mortal life. He was the original lord of the underworld. Of anything that died came to the underworld. And of animals and mankind in the west, watch over the west. And he was the first titan in the Great War to use technology. He invented this big-ass spear in the war, and he would, like, pierce people. They called him the piercer. So, yeah, Iapetos. And his other son was Atlas, holding the way of the world, you know. So, we owe Iapetos our forms. Because in terms of Aquarius, yeah. And genetic recombination. And of course, Oceanus is the celestial sea. And really, the Greeks saw Neptune as the god of, like, the Mediterranean Sea. And Oceanus was the titan of, like, the world ocean that wrapped the whole world. And when you look at what their descriptions were, it basically is what we would call dimensions. That's why Neptune uses his trident to open up the dimensions. You know? So when you bring these into the signs, it adds this whole other layer, you know. I've been working with these lately, and it's been very exciting. So I'm like, Taya is calling you forth! And so it adds a nice level of mythic essence to it. Anyway, aspects. Aspects, of course, the dialogue between the planets, interpreting aspects and astrological statements of being, a planet's psychological functions being expressed through the archetype of the blah, 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 and the field of the blah, 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 modified by aspects. You know? So the aspects are where it's at, in terms of like bringing it together. The word aspects means to glance, aspectus. All the planets are checking each other out in the chart, you know. And so we can bring all these things in, like we just said, plot motifs, everything. So when you're really working with the mythic elements of the chart, it really brings the aspects to life. Aspects, as we know as scholars, is the 3-for-1 education. Woohoo! You learn them once, and you get to apply them to your character, chart interpretation, evolutions, transits progression, sinistry. You're Saturn squaring my moon. And that's great. There are types of aspects. Normally we just work with geometrical aspects. In my book I'm introducing 2 new levels of aspects, archetypal aspects and conjugate aspects. So let's go to geometrical here. I recently went on a road trip on my bike, and I threw my laptop in my bike, and I rode 3,200 miles over the Rocky Mountains from Boulder, Colorado to British Columbia to Seattle. I flew my kid in, bought him an iPad, got him a bike off Craigslist. Winter REI outfitted him, and we rode all the way to San Francisco for his first semester of 9th grade. Father-son trip. And and the whole way, before I left, I was putting in my standard orbs in SolarFire, loading into the new MacBook Pro, and next thing you know, I'm running parallel so I can run Windows on here. So the thing is I get this moment of inspiration. And the universe said, try the Fibonacci sequence. I was like, what? So, for the conjunction and the opposition, when the focus is 1, because you don't divide a circle at all, except for it's a half, you know, it's the fraction of the circle. So say use the 13-degree orb. It's like, wow, that's pretty expansive orb there. And then if it's out of sign, use an 8-degree orb. Diffuse it down with this dissociate. And then for the triangle square, 8 degrees, diffuse 5 degrees, narrow it a little bit. quintile and sextile, 5 degrees. 3 degrees if they're out of sign or diffuse. Obviously, the quintile cannot be out of sign, but it can be, you know, harmonious element in harmonious mode or harmonious mode in harmonious element. Then you got the quincunx, 3 degrees, 2 degrees, and the biquintile, and the crescent. I call the 45-degree crescent, just because that when in any cycle, when a planet gets to 45 degrees, like the moon, that's the crescent moon, that's the crescent angle. So if you want to understand the semi-square, it's just the crescent angle. It's like a plant trying to come up through the earth, you know, like in the plant cycle. Rudyard's plant cycle, right? It's like break through the inertia, resistance. That's why it's tense, you know? It's half a square. And then, of course, I call the gibbous angle. Well, this is called the gibbous phase. Right here. In astronomy, gibbous means almost full, but not full yet. So when you're in a gibbous phase, you're a healer. You're good at bringing things to the budding phase, the perfecting things. And then when you're over here, that's the waning gibbous, right here, starting the disseminating phase. So whatever phase you were born under, if you're born in the dark moon phase, you have a whole character that associated with that based on your birth lunation type. So, you know, I was born in the sun here and the moon in there. So, of course, that means, you know, you measure the angle to find out where you are in these eight phases. What I've done in my Tao astrology book is I've connected with these with the I Ching. So basically, down here at the bottom is Earth, right? Which is this one. And at the top is Heaven. Then you have, you know, thunder and fire and lake. And balsamic phase is mountain. Go to the mountain. Like those big Chinese paintings with the mountain. Look at it far. So you can actually look at these. You can look at your birth phase. And you can, like, look at your... these phases, and you can put this one over this one and get like a hexagram for your lifetime. And then you can take your progress moon, your progress sun, and you can get the phase that is and put it over that, and you can make a hexagram for that 3.5 years or the next 3.5 days in the sky. So you can work I Ching into your astrology. Yeah, it's really cool. The Book of Changes. I mean, if some Chinese people wrote a book called The Book of Changes, us astrologers should be like all about some Book of Changes. You know? Of course, when I got down the Fibonacci sequence, you know, it goes 13, 5, 5, 3, 2, 1. I got down here and it said use 1 again for the parallels. I was like, could you use 1 twice in Fibonacci? Parallels are angles above the celestial equator and below. So you got these parallels. When planets are in parallel, they pretty much amplify whatever else is happening in that planet. It's not just a conjunction and opposition. It's an amplification effect. You know, when you look at the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction that happened at the time of Christ, 7 BC, Jupiter and Saturn were conjunct in declination and longitude. So it was like bright in the ancient world, you know. So such a little trip with the Fibonacci sequence. So what I mean, there's geometrical aspects, there's archetypal and conjugate. So archetypal aspects they can either be whole sign aspects. Like if you've got a planet in Aries, it's square anything in Cancer. That's the archetypal aspect. And the only time I literally look at archetypal aspects is with the seven traditional planets. Like, a lot of people don't look at the relationship between their Mercury and their Moon if they don't have a traditional geometrical aspect. Problem with that theory is that you have a mind and a heart in one consciousness and they are interacting. They're not interacting because they don't have a mathematical angle. Your heart and your mind work together. So it's important to understand that archetypal relationship between your mind and your heart no matter what. Like, my moon's in Gemini. It's like a little kid over there, you know? My Mercury's in Capricorn. It's like an 80-year-old. So I've always had this, like, conversation between this little, like, let's go play. And it's like, oh, stay focused, serious studies. So anyway, we're calling for a break. Gail is cutting me off here. No, just kidding. And we're going to take a food break and come back. And we'll go into this next.
10 minutes.
10-minute break.
Okay, we're having a break now.
Yeah, we're having a break now.
So, are those all the Titans?
Yeah, those are all the Titans. All the Titans.
Number one. Number two.
Those are the 12 original Titans. They gave birth to other Titans like Helios.
The first crew.
The first crew with the 12.
Okay, like this. Okay, now, did you do the step to the next? Which one are you talking about? Do you just basically outline, well, right, so we talk about the executive Titans.
Yeah.
The Dwan
worked it out. There's a whole chapter in the book about. I got a whole like sapient symbol for the Deccan and Dwan based on the textbook.
One thing you said early on,
May. It'll all become clear in May.
They do.
Cool. I got a whole chapter in the book that's about I'm downloading a whole new set of sapient symbols, but they're for the decans and the dwarfs. You've got like a meta decan symbol and then a dwarf symbol based on the actual archetype, and they're blending from all the levels. So this whole new
stuff. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it.
Well, Jupiter governs a fire sign, Seth, and it also guides a water sign, Pisces. So, Jupiter's archetype and connection with science governs a fire sign and a water sign. But when you look at the quality, it's hot, and it's hot, it raises it, and it's moist, it makes connections. And moist becoming hot is an ancient green element of air. And so Jupiter also has to deal with philosophy, education, space, air, yes. Exactly. Jupiter doesn't want to be grounded. Totally. Yes. Yes.
You remember, didn't you?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I met you somewhere.
No wonder.
Oh, you mean your sense of
I have a
You should move up if you want. These seats are open.
Yeah.
Or one of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm
Because, like, when you have a minute, you can read more. She was saying, like, Yes. Most of my charts.
So here's the 12 original titans right here. And then when I wrote down all their rules and everything, and the quick retrace that one center, then I wrote down, like, who gave birth to who and how it came down.
Not really, I don't have
the lessons and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's like everybody's in here somewhere. Like, there's Hecate, you know, and Porta Zeus and the Titan Masi and who's the villains. These are all
You can see the action.
You know, when you have a pod and a part of who you are in your mind, where does it go? It seats down in and takes its place. The memories clustered together. Memories of positive association.
So it has that
very old archetype. It makes it clustered together. It's called deletion. Take notes like a madman. Like, what is all those titans? This is kind of how I work. I get visions, and then I like have models of consciousness coming to me in the form of trees, and I'm like, I gotta write this down. Wow. So I pass that around too. You can look at this. Here's where I got the download on the Greek Titans. I was like, oh my god, write down everything there is to know about titans and track it all down. That's my Mercury and Capricorn. Well, I'll send that around this way if anybody wants to look at madness going happening. And then I wrote a chapter on the evolution of the architect, and I did research for 12 years, and I found out everything I know about archetypes. They're fluid, evolving, multivalent, participatory nature, numinosity, speakability, ordering influence, arranges intensity, mediating power. So this is like everything I know about archetypes, and this is like one chapter in the book.
So, so you basically put this in your book.
Yeah.
You're going to get in a story.
But
not that image.
This image is very similar.
Yeah, that's that image.
That's the image.
The whole thing with all the writing.
You put your email down there. He's put this probably this writing out.
Several pages worth
on this one.
Yeah, I want to check that out. This is everything I know about aspects. It's like, we're going to get to that, though.
I remember those.
I basically have, like, hundreds of these all over my house, and I just write them down. This is all how the myths happen between all the planets. That's where we're getting to now. We'll look at that. I'll pass that out in a second. So, where were we? Oh, tomorrow, we're doing a workshop here from what? 1 to 5. So if you want to, like, go deep with this material, and, really master it as much as you can in 4 hours. One of the things I'll be talking about is the evolution of the archetype through 5 phases. My book's called The Tao of Astrology, The Way. Tao is a character that has the, which means movement and this is like intelligence and this is motion, so it's like intelligent motion. And the word Te is, also has to do with movement, and when you look at it means to move through life with a vision of the heart. So Te is pretty cool. They need a poet to translate these languages, you know. Ooh.
Oh no!
One of those markers, huh? I thought it was just the black one, but I guess the blue one is doing that too.
Nice art. Sign of the cyclone.
So, but tomorrow, what the focus is going to be is about the evolution archetypes.
Put those away, and you can turn these.
Oh, okay. Ah, that's a real Espen marker. I recognize that. Okay, good. So basically, I'm working with the Chinese Wu Xin, which is like the five elements of the Chinese. Their elements are different than our elements. Like, their elements are about phases in any cycle of change. And so they have like fire, earth, metal, water, and wood. But theirs aren't psychological states, like air people are smart and water people are empathic. Theirs aren't psychological states like our elements. Their elements are phases in any cycle of change. So what I've done is I got a vision about how the archetypes evolve through these 5 phases. So for instance, Aries starts off at fire phase, being very coarse but very primitive and fiery, as like the daredevil, the risk taker. You know that Aries image of like the guy who just wants to go bungee jumping. He just wants to, like, take a risk. So the risk taker. Then you have, as the archetype matures, it goes to earth phase, it becomes more settled, and it becomes like the warrior defending the village, or the adventurer on a quest. Suddenly there's a mission at hand. Then once you've been the a warrior for a while, you become the leader. At metal phase, it's about specialization in society. So at metal phase, the archetype matures into societal, like, expression, you know, so the warrior becomes the leader. Last man standing, you're the leader now, you know? And then the leader, once he finds out his unique leadership style, opens up the heart to more of a humanitarian expression at the water phase. And then the warrior becomes the true trailblazer, pioneer. That kind of Aries that we know is like, he's blazing a new trail. And then that level of the archetype, when the spirit descends at wood phase, and you have the highest expression of Aries being the true hero champion. And the champion is no better than the aggressive young buck risk taker. The shadow's actually more subtle, you know, because at the hero level, you're like arrogant, like Achilles with his heel. He didn't think he'd get defeated. The guy standing in line who's angry because the line's not going fast enough, that's easy to recognize. It's just a coarser level of the archetype. So all these archetypes go through 5 phases. We're passing lists around for email if you want a PDF of this class tonight. And a lot of this stuff is right out of the book. It's coming out in May, Tao of Astrology. My life work. At 21, I wrote my first book, Celestial Renaissance and Revolution of Astrology, after 12 years of study. And then I put it all together, and it blew my mind. And then I started working other stuff. And I collected a mountain of research about 5 feet tall. And now I have about this much left sitting at home on Catherine's bed in her guest room. It's like that much more to go, and I'll be done. So May is my deadline. And, you know, when you're 21, 22 and you're doing things, it reflects what you're going to be doing at 42, the Uranian cycle, you know. Like Isaac Newton developed calculus 21, 22. And at 42, wrote Theory of Gravity, Principia. So I was writing my first book then, and now putting together my life story. So anyway, it's called The Tao of Australia. It's coming out in May. And tomorrow we're going to talk about all how to bring in all these archetypes, all the levels that we're talking about. The emotions, the cognitive states, the plot motifs that just really bring the charts alive at all new level. My friend is Aquarius, starts off with the rebel nonconformist. Says, screw that, I'm going against the grain. And then, once they start experimenting, they grow at Earth phase into a more settled, a scientist inventor. Like, ah, we'll put this and this to go together. At first they're just doing it for to be a rebel and blow something up, like the laboratory. But then they become a true scientist. They're like, wow, I want to investigate this phenomenon and do an experiment. Then at the metal phase, specialization, they actually go and go, wow, I got this new thing I invented. Let's go reform society with it. So they become reformers, freedom fighters. And then when the heart opens, they become true humanitarians, altruists. And then they know that we're only as strong as the weakest link. So they're like, let's get everybody's gifts online. Well, how do they do that? Well, they go become astrologers. Well, actually, the highest level of Aquarius is the cosmic genius / philanthropist, but also the astrologer or the prophet, one who sees the future. So people, a lot of Aquarius, just have a leg in the future. They're like 50 years, 30 years ahead of their time, and they're trying to like live, trying to channel the future into the present, you know? I had a theory once that maybe lots of Aquarius or Uranian energy are just like reincarnated aliens that never visited the solar system yet. And they don't have any like connection to it. They're like, this is weird. These are strange. I used to have antlers. Or bug tentacles or whatever their alien society has. I can't wait till we find out their solar systems and find out like how the archetypes manifest with a solar system of only 5 planets. Like how because the zodiac's universal. Zodiac goes the circle of life. So these archetypes run through the whole universe based on the beginning of the eternal being dissolved into rhythmic vibration and the one, two, three. Even in the Tao it says, the Tao begot the one begot the two begot the three begot the 10,000 things. So once you get to the modes, you're good to go. anyway, archetypal aspects are cool because you got whole sign aspect and if a planet occupies Aries, it automatically forms an archetypal sextile with every planet in Gemini and Aquarius. The two signs that are 6 degrees from Aries. So I highly recommend studying the archetypal aspects between the core polarities of Sun, Moon, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Even back it up in time to their conjunction. You know, you'd think that the Sun and Moon would be pretty quick in terms of its conjunction. But like, you back Uranus and Neptune up, you're getting back to like 1821. You know? So everybody in this room, mostly, unless you're born past 1991, too, when Uranus and Neptune came along, we're all products of the Industrial Revolution. In terms of the Uranus-Neptune cycle, it takes 172 years to come back together. It goes around the zodiac 24 times. It hits the beginning of a sign, then it hits the end of a sign. Like before Capricorn in 1821, in the Industrial Revolution, we had Sagittarius, Age of Exploration, 2 shots. For them, Dark Ages, and you know, Scorpio. So we had all this like intense transformation that went on there. So these guys cycle. Whenever Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto get together all at once in the sky, like in 575 BCE, when like across the Earth you had this sort of Plutonic transformative rebirth of the collective Neptunian, imaginative, religious, spiritual, collective mythos, combined with this sudden awakening, and you had Buddhism popping up, and the Tao popping up, and Zoroastrianism, and Buddhism and the Greeks with Pythagoras and Thales and all these like awakening. So you had all across the world these awakenings. Those only happen once every 4,000 years. So the next one's like 3,376, but it doesn't matter. It matters where we are now, and we just had we're in this second cycle. It was in Taurus, by the way. In 575. That's why the Buddha is like, be you now. But so we're in the second stage of something on that 4,000 year level. But
think everybody's signed up.
We got Frank too. Alright. So so that's important to understand your cycle date. But
we're going to move forward. What I mean by a conduit aspect, what am I calling a conduit? Or it's a transpersonal.
Occur when one of the seven traditional planets forms an aspect of one of the invisible to the naked eye, modern planets or core planets. If you've got Moon square Pluto, that would be a conduit aspect. The personal planet acts as a conduit for the transpersonal force of the unseen planet. When one of these aspects involves one of the threshold guardians of Mercury, Ceres, Chiron, or Pluto, from my Kabbalistic-looking diagram at the bottom, it's also called a portal aspect. Those guys like to open up portals. Because Mercury, Ceres, Chiron, and Pluto occupy specific thresholds of consciousness in the solar system, they act as doorways or nexus points in the consciousness. If one of the planets involved in a conduit aspect is Chiron, Uranus, Neptune, or Pluto, it's also called a generational aspect. So generational aspects are common to millions of people born during the same couple of years and sharing a similar generation mythic plot motif. Like the generation now growing up that has all that 1991, 92 Uranus, Neptune. They're like the internet kids. They're like learning to speak through intuition. It's my kid's 17, and I'm just like, wow. But he knew astrology by the age of one. They used to have my wall hanging chart on the wall with little hair twists moving around. Dad, wake up. We got to move the moon 13 degrees. He was like, one. He would walk into this class right here and be like, well, look, an astrology chart. Mercury's the planet of the mind. You know? So astrology was part of his homeschooling. I didn't let the home system happen until he was in third grade. He started slacking off in his homeschool. And he went to school. He's like, Dad, nobody likes learning there. Everyone just messes around, and I know more words than the teacher knows. He's like, should I come back home and study? He wrote his first poem at age five and a half, called The Web of Life. I said, he goes, because I used to go to open mic poetry nights, and he always wanted to get into this mythic poetic. I use a lot of poetry in my readings to really bring people into the imagery. And so I have a whole book of like Pluto poems, Neptune poems, Uranian poems. His first poem goes, at five, he goes, the web of life. He goes, the mountains are shadowing again as moonbeams gleam through the night. The web of life is at high tide, and it's nice to be outside. Yeah. You can find my heart in the universe where rainbows reflect eternity. So the kids like writing poetry like that. So, you know, these kids are amazing coming up. Sophia's one of them. She's in my next movie. I forgot that I met her in Sedona, at the last Sedona, with Philip Sedgwick, and we filmed her when she was 16. She was like breaking down Uranus and Neptune like she's been studying astrology for 8 years. It's going to be cool in my next film to have. So my first film was Return of the Magi with 40 astrologers in it. And the next one's going to be about chart interpretation, not the history of astrology. But anyway, back to this. So we got generational aspects. This is Gemini Moon. Back to this. Right. Well, when multiple aspects combine their influence, it's called a configuration, acting as a deeply ingrained psychological complex within the individual. A configuration involving three or more actual planets, or dwarf planets, is called a planetary configuration. So you've got like a planet here, and a planet there, and a planet there, and there in T-square, and that's a planetary, because it's got three actual things, right? Whereas, if a planet or planets form an aspect or multiple aspects to a non-planetary axis of polarity, such as the nodal axis, you may have a planet squaring the nodal axis, the descendant, ascendant axis, the midheaven nadir axis, the lot of fortune axis. It's called a polarity configuration. What happens, a lot of astrology books in the West emphasize midheaven and ascendant aspects and neglected descendant and nadir aspects, which is totally reflective of our culture, because all we care about is me and my career. Whereas in Asia, they'd be like, my relationships and my family. In China, it's a whole different, like, perspective over there, you know? So it's like, we need to, like, bring that back around and go, like, look, if a planet's aspecting the ascendant, it's also aspecting the descendant. If there's a sextile to the ascendant, there's a trine to the descendant. You can't, so it's a configuration automatically via that there's got to be two aspects. So that's why I'm differentiating between a planetary configuration and a polarity configuration. Because, you know, if you've got a planet aspecting your nodes, that planet is asking to be of service to help you move through that nodal cycle and express the beauty of the south node as your gift, but to move toward that north node in terms of your evolution. Like Elvis and Einstein both have the south node in Leo and their north node in Aquarius. They're both called to revolutionize the world. Elvis stays stuck in some Leo I'm the king. You know, for Elvis, it was about Elvis, you know. He said, and then Leo gave us a heart, died of a heart attack. Does that show someone who has evolved past their self-known addictions? So, I mean, Einstein was creative. He played the violin, but he became known as the Aquarian scientist, cosmic genius, reformer of science. All those Aquarian archetypes. He had all of them.
You know, one thing they don't know about Elvis, he was a theosophist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he had
no, no, I'm not saying that Elvis didn't do any humanitarian work. He did great humanitarian work. But at the end of the day, the guy died of a heart attack, you know, and Leo Gerber's the heart. And, you know, when you watch those old films and he's arguing with his business manager about how the contract's going down, you can tell he's not totally into the humanitarian thing. He's like, it's about me and I'm Elvis, you know. So, you know, you get that. Because Leo's the archetype of the performer. So the South Node is not a bad thing. It's a beautiful thing. Actually, astrology is really going toward more of a synthesis. I always say, if you want to know why the hell you're here, take the sun and its sign, planet, its aspects. Take the north node and its sign, planet, aspect. And take the midheaven, which I use this for the symbol for the midheaven in my new book. The middle of heaven. So take those three and you get a very good idea of why the heck you're here. Because you got life purpose, spiritual destiny, and vocation. You combine those into a meta symbol of why the heck you're here, and you will understand. And then you want to know where you came from? Moon? Genetics? fluids? Oh, South Node? Cultural slash racial scoop of karma? Throw it into the recipe when you took your first breath. And then, of course, the nadir, which connects with the deep, you know, the bottom of the chart, the deep roots, the ancestors and all that. So, anyway. That's why the heck you're here, and that's where you came from, and that's where you're going. So it's really a combined composite symbol, those three. You can bring in Jupiter up here, Saturn. What I do like to do is, you know, Saturn's got a lot to do with your past and karma. Jupiter has to do with where you're going, future and inspiration. So what I like to do is think of the north node. One time a client said, you know that one symbol you were talking about is really important, the headphones? And I was like, the headphones? Listening for my destiny. And then this is like a little pulveron holding the water in the path. But yeah, the headphones. The headphones is calling you to perform your high destiny. Some people get lucky, like me, I have my sun in Aquarius, I have my north node in Aquarius. So I have become an astrologer at 14. Yeah. It doesn't mean that a sun conjunct the south node is a bad thing. It's just a creative, everything's a creative opportunity. It's all about your level of consciousness. Just like in synastry, you can take two people who have the worst synastry, squares, opposites, everywhere, everywhere, and they have like the best relationship. They challenge each other. They love it. It's passionate. Because the level of consciousness trumps any astrology. You get two people that are just like wanting to just throw stuff at each other and kill each other and fight and scream and holler. It's like, you guys even haven't even learned basic communication. That's back in the third house. We're going to send you back to elementary school. Anyway, that's where we're going tomorrow. So if you want to come, come. And we'll take you on a journey through your archetypes and see where that leads. So each living being has a unique aspect pattern present in the chart at the moment of birth, symbolizing the inner structure of the psyche. Inside that tree, at the heartwood, you've got this aspect pattern. I think they should make mandalas for people with their aspect grid. You just walk around with it, meditating on it, you know. When studying aspects, it is a mistake to consider one aspect between two planets in isolation. Problem with that is the fact that we can only focus deeply on one thing at a time. So we got a problem here. In studying your aspect pattern, it's helpful to write it down on a large piece of paper. And that's what I do with classes in Boulder. I'm like, okay, we're going to write down our aspects. And we're going to make notes by everything, and you're going to see the emergence happen, you know? So write it all down on paper, and make notes next to each aspect. Start with the sun and moon. Work your way deeper into the crystal. As you begin to take notes on the effects of each aspect, the information on the page begins to expand, and you will begin to see patterns emerge, the mythic themes. You will begin to understand how the planets, symbolizing the various forces of consciousness, are working together in a dynamic, unified way. Also make note of any configurations that emerge. These are the centerpieces of your being. Once you develop a comprehensive view of the inner workings of your psyche, then you can go back and look at chart evolutions and patterns like, oh my God, when Pluto crossed my T-square focal planet, look what happened. And so when things like that happen, they're still happening. Time is only linear down here. It's far spherical up there. So in a dimensional way, you can actually go back to an old transit. It's almost like when a transit happens, a new railroad path opens up. You might not go down it yet, or you might go down a very painful version of it, but it's always there. You can go back to explore, you know? So, and you can actually gain wisdom from that, because there's like future selves and past selves, and everybody's here together doing things.
Antlers.
Yeah. So, when I look at, where I want to take this, Mercury got taped up. So you got, I like to think of the inner five planets right here as the core of a human soul. You got the sun, which is your vital force, your life force. You got the mind, the cognitive function. You got Venus, love. What's a soul without some love, right? You've got a body, the earth, symbolizing that. You got a destiny. You've got a moon, which is your heart, your emotional field. And you got Mars, fire, volition, drive. You know, every soul has free will as the last ingredient. Boom! And so, I like to look at the whole sign aspects here, especially the lunation cycle, Mercury, Venus. Like I was saying, you know, when you look at Mercury and Venus, you're looking at the relationship between your mind and your heart in terms of the aesthetic, social function. Basically, every planet has a kind of intelligence that goes with it. Like Mercury has to do with our what we think of as intelligence, like cognitive, figuring it out, you know, doing some math, like regular old intellect. Whereas actually every planet symbolizes a kind of intelligence, you know? The moon is emotional intelligence. Like it's been underrated. Now people are like, wow, that person has high emotional IQ. You hear it now. Venus is social aesthetic intelligence, grace. Mars is kinesthetic intelligence. You see these uniquely manifest when you have a quintile. Like the reason I do my thing with these papers every day, I write down like, here's all the aspects between all the seven traditional planets and how they relate to every myth ever known to the Greeks. Right here. The reason I do that is because I have Jupiter in a quintile to Jupiter, Neptune, and quintile. See this quintile right here? It's a perfect quintile from Jupiter, Neptune to my sun in Aquarius. So my cosmic astrologer guy says, hey, give me some download from the mystical depths of the 12th house. I get these visions, you know? So, and the moon in Gemini says, hey, I'll write it down. So those quintiles are really interesting. I always studied people with lots of quintiles and biquintiles. Like Mozart, he had Neptune in the 12th house. Heard the music this year. I hear like German symphonies when I'm in the shower in the morning. I'm like, but I told the universe, I was like, I got 23 projects right now, so I'm gonna wait till I'm 58 to learn music. That's just the way it's gonna be. Anyway, so I'm already a musician. We're astrologers. We play the biggest instrument in the solar system. The solar system is our instrument. My point is that when you have a lot of quintiles and biquintiles, you're tapped into that creative genius through divine inspiration. So Mozart had 10 quintiles and biquintiles in his chart. And I counted mine, I have 10 too. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going crazy. I'm going to write another symphony. But even if you have one, it's really cool because what quintiles symbolize is going off the zodiac. You're not in these little 30-degree increments anymore. You're coming in from a higher level. They need meditation and visualization to bring forth the gift. It's a unique talent combining two different kinds of intelligence that's never been seen before in your particular expression. So if you got a guy who has Mars, Jupiter, he's got kinesthetic intelligence, movement kind of combined with Jupiterian philosophical intelligence. You got like a Greek philosopher guy who's like Stoic or something. You got all these beautiful intelligences. Jupiter is philosophical, spiritual intelligence. Saturn is structural intelligence, engineering. These guys know how to put some stuff together, build a building. Chiron has to do with healing intelligence and awakening. Chiron's the awakener that gets you out here. Chiron's like the guy that shows up and says, hey, are you ready to awaken? Sometimes I get a client and I'll sense like they're not ready for Chiron yet. I go in there, they might like crack. So I don't even go past. I just stay in here, you know, and be like, all right, let's work out some. Let's work on this stuff right here. We'll get out here later, you know, because not everybody's ready for divine mind, divine love, divine will, you know. You get to these two early, you can like become like a homeless person walking around going, but because you fragment, you know. You need to be prepared. That's why Chiron symbolizes the gateway of preparation so you're ready to go out here and not lose your freaking mind, you know. Because Chiron's about awakening through the path, you know, and a devotion to your craft. So Chiron, when I started doing astrology charts professionally, I had been studying for 9 years. I started studying the month Dane Rudyard died, and my teacher gave me Dane Rudyard. I was reading about galactic consciousness and joining the Pleroma. I was like, this is so cool. And so when Chiron got to my midheaven, I actually started doing charts public down in Key West on the beach for tourists. So I built a big card table with a big moving wheel with little game pieces, and I just like made five charts a day. And that's how I learned all this. I didn't learn all this from books. I just like studied all the books, put it away, and then I went and did charts. And then when I did like five charts a night, I came home so inspired from what I learned. I wrote it all down, and it became my first book, Celestial Renaissance. So just by putting it all together. So, you know, Uranus is intuitive intelligence, right? Cosmic intelligence. Neptune is psychic intelligence. People of strong Neptune have that sense of like, they just know that they know. Both of these are intuitive, but Neptune's more of an emotional intuition. Feel it in your gut. Uranus is more of a flash of brilliance or insight. And then Pluto is like regenerational intelligence. So you have a planet going with Pluto, it's like it brings in this whole other intelligence. So we're just mixing all these cool intelligences in the chart. And then, there's the Jupiter-Saturn cycles, the cultural establishment cycle. That's the one that establishes through history. This is actually more important than the outer planet cycles. The outer planet cycles are great and all. These guys set the foundation for it. With these 800-year periods, you know, 200 years per element, that bring, when they're in the fire signs, they always bring massive rapid land expansion and new charismatic leaders, like and new nations. America popped up during a fire wave. Roman Empire popped up, fire wave. The Akkadians popped up, fire wave. So you always get these amazing new cultures on the planet with new scientific revolutions, advances in metallurgy, and then goes the earth wave, and you have all this, like, you know, industrial revolution, price of coal, you know, you get all this, like, advances in trade. Like, five cycles ago, the Lydians created coinage and fixed location marketplaces called stores. They had markets on the weekend, but they didn't have, like, a store you could go to. So the Lydians came along and invented coinage and stores. That happened during an earth wave. To go back all the way to the Sumerians, during their first earth wave of my 5,000-year study, I studied 5,000 years, 250 conjunctions of Jupiter-Saturn. I wrote them all down, took 3 weeks, wrote them all down, and then write down everything that happened in history, all the big and medium themes. And then I stepped back, because I wrote it all down on a big piece of paper, and I was like, I just taped them all along, and I see the pattern! I felt like, I solved history. because every time Jupiter-Saturn comes back to the airwave, there's always an intellectual awakening that brings about massive transformations in politics, economics, and thinking. And suddenly, and you're coming out of that earth wave, and so boom, you know, 1200, it was 800 years ago. We got the Jupiter-Saturn cycle in Aquarius starting in 2020. It's going to be 200 years of air sign conjunctions. So we got an awakening happening again, just like the Renaissance. The Scholasticism, 1200. Albertus Magnus, who's considered a polymath, master of like 13 disciplines, smartest man on the planet, he wrote a book called Speculum Astronomiae, a Christian defense of astrology. He was considered a PhD in the Catholic Church, arguing with Ptolemy that a wise man governs his planets, not the other way around. So we got like major proponents of astrology within the Catholic Church. His student was Aquinas, you know, Thomas. So you got the whole history of philosophy hinging on these guys, and it's like, these guys were right way into astrology because they were recovering all the Greek material. We should have had the Renaissance in 400, because 800 years before that, 400 BCE, it came back to 400, and there's supposed to be a Renaissance of the classic Greek culture. But guess what? Age of Pisces has started, and the Catholic Church shut it down. Within 3 years, around 393, you can see that they ordered the burning of the Great Library, the closing of the Delphic Oracle, and the canceling of the Olympic Games. We're not praying to Greek gods anymore. So they basically said no to the way that was trying to emerge. And as a result, within 100 years, Constantine had several earthquakes, several plagues, several famines, and sacked by the Goths and the Huns, and then later the Vikings, just to add a little bit of... Meanwhile, across the world, the Asians said yes to the Renaissance. In the Gupta culture in India, they brought us all kinds of beautiful things. The Kama Sutra, chess, Bodhidharma got enlightened, they invented Zen, which in 1200 went to Japan as Zen. It was Chan before. Now it's coming back again, because we're moving back to the airwave. 1981, hit an air sign. They're like, Zen, everybody's talking about Zen. So these things are on a cycle. 1200 BCE, King David and Solomon, and the wisdom of, you know, the Hebrew culture. Where we get a lot of astrology from, because they came directly from the Sumerians, you know. And they had a cool language, like they wrote the word light, Aleph, Vav, Resh. Aleph was an archetype. It was the first letter. It meant the infinite potential of the spirit to be anything, nothing able to be anything. And then, so the divine mind, or spiritual potential. Vav was like the fertility letter, the divine bringing fertility into the void, you know? And then, of course, Resh was manifestation and creation. So within their word, for A-U-R, this is their word Ur, Aur, for light, where we have Aurora, Aura, Uranos, the ancient city Ur, where Abraham came from. The real meaning of this word was spiritual potential fertilizes creation. So the way they put their language together was like, really cool, that happened during Air Wave, that's coming again. So I'm joining with this ancestor going, all right, inspire me, let's go. So, I mean, if you take the lines of the Bible apart, Hebrew archetype like this, like it says, the first, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Remember, first line in the Bible? If you take it apart like this, it says, the first fruits of the Spirit aspiring to express eternity through a fountain of divine wisdom was the creation of the celestial dimensions of the manifest world. I'm like, they need a poet. Give them a poet. So anyway, all this wisdom's coming back. It's never forgotten. Nothing's ever forgotten. It all gets written into the fabric of space and time. And then individuals come back and go, oh yeah, where did I leave off? Oh yeah. Okay. So, next. Some of the new keywords I have for... this isn't about the mythic, but this is about some of the new keywords that I'm coming up with for the key phrases, for the like conjunction. Emergence of a new cycle of possibilities. So, empowerment through intensification. So, if you have Jupiter conjunct Venus, Venus intensifies Jupiter, and Jupiter intensifies Venus. So, shrink through amalgamation. Amalgamation, when they come together, create something that was not there before, like emergence. Novelty through combination. So you could say, this planet combines with this one. Amplifies. Fascination effect through amplification. Symbiosis through integrated fusion. Aren't those cool keywords for the conjunction? Integrated. The opposition is realization of complementary opposites. So, tension for reconciliation. You know? So, reconcile. So you could say, my Venus is reconciling with my moon. If they're in opposition. And that'll help you understand, like, why do I always give up my emotional needs to make someone else happy? Or give up my desires, Venus, to make someone else emotionally happy? When I should just be strong and be myself, and if they don't like me, oh well. You know, at least I'm being true to my authentic self. Illumination through confrontation. Sometimes it takes confrontation for illumination. Awareness through contradiction. So contradicts would be the keyword. Attraction through polarization. And equilibrium through resolution. So that's some cool keywords for the oppositions and conjunctions. Then, of course, you got the trine and the square. The trine is creativity through graceful action. This is the Wu Wei aspect, where things just flow so naturally because you get lazy and take it for granted. And so I call it support through invigoration, alliance through cooperation, harmony through synthesis. They're synthesizing. See, the conjunction establishes the thesis. The opposition is the antithesis. The trine is the synthesis. So, anyway, it's harmony through synthesis, it's facilitation for reinforcement, and flexibility through blending. There's a nice talent there in the square. It's conflict for growth and passion, right? So it's crisis for engagement. We're talking about engagement. There's that word again. Productivity through challenge. Volatility through restriction. You try to hold something down. That's how the square feels. Maturation. These two planets are going to mature through resistance. It's like resistance training, like weightlifting, you know. Transformation through interference. My Venus is interfering with my Pluto. So, and of course, I got the quintile. I mean, I got all of them all the way into the semi-squares and all those gibbous six, though, presence. Creative genius through divine inspiration. Originality through magnetism. If you got a quintile, there's something magnetic coming off you that people feel that you might not even be aware of. You got to tap into your quintiles. Visualize how to bring those two different kinds of intelligence together into a new synthesis and express it in the houses that they're bridging through the image bridge, you know. So, like I do it through the 12th and the 2nd, nature and spirituality, you know. So the Tao of Australia. Specialization through hyperfocus. Brilliance through experimentation and play. Insight through visualization. Inspiration through bridging intelligence. That's what quintiles are about. So, anyway, aspect guidelines, this is all old hat for anybody who knows astrology, but The most important overlooked principle is the alchemical essence of the two plants forming a relationship. How do they react in a vacuum alone before anything else? You know? Speed, nature of the slower planet usually seeks expression, expansion, and focus through the lens of the faster, more personal planet. That's that conduit aspect I was talking about. Where, like, my Pluto is opposing my Mars. So, oh, Pluto's trying to work its agenda through my Mars. You know? I saw a guy once had Pluto conjunct Mars and Leo on his ascendant.
Wow.
And I was doing his chart, and then he sat down. Somebody else gave me his data, and I was just putting it in the computer. And he sat down, and I looked at him, and I was like, whoa, right in his face. He looked like he had a giant, like somebody chopped him with an axe right across the face. It was a birthmark. He had Pluto conjunct Mars, and he said, I was like, dude. One time this girl showed up, she was 16, I'm going to mention something, and I was looking at her chart before she got there, it was at some bookstore in North Carolina, and this, I looked at her chart, I was like, wow, Capricorn rising with Saturn in the ascendant, the face of wisdom. Little did I know, she sits down, 16-year-old girl, solid hair all the way down to her back, gray hair, 16,
wow.
I was like, wow, the archetypes manifesting. So waxing aspects seek to create and expand structures and fuel activity. Waning aspects, when they're coming back around, seek to reorient, contemplate, and understand the meaning behind activities and structures. So these are very, like, modifiers to basically understanding aspects, but it's easy to mistake a waxing square for a waning square. Waning square is, we're going inward, we're reorienting things, we're reflecting on things, we're going to have a revolution of consciousness. Whereas a waxing square would be like, let's create a structure to contain the spiritual vision that's been deposited in our soul. You know, so it's more like, it's like the plant's growing. You know, it's not bearing the fruit and giving forth its thing yet. And then, of course, applying aspects are full of anticipation, mystery, and power, ready to be unleashed in the psyche or event. So in character, they're unresolved themes in the past, because you've got a planet here, and there's another planet coming in. That's an applying aspect. It's moving away. It's separating. So if it's applying, it's more powerful. Why? Because by progression, it's going to hit in your early stages of life and lock it in deep right into the contours of your tree rings of experience, you know? And so, in the events, it's a shift that's emerging. And of course, you have separating aspects. When planets are going bye-bye, they're more relaxed, steady, reliable, symbolizing resolved conflicts, interactions that are now seeking expression and growth. They're like, you've already been on that battlefield. You did it. Now it's time to take it, that experience and do something new with it. So gift-seeking expression, germination of a new theme. So this is how you can integrate storytelling with these aspects and how they're actually moving. They don't look like they're moving if you're just looking at a blank chart, but they are. They're all, everything's in motion. And, of course, eighth harmonic aspects are the conjunction, crescents, the square, the gibbous, and the opposition. Tend to create the most strife and require focus, concentration, and consciousness to express creatively. So the first thing I do with clients is sit down and be like, let's draw you a big map of all your aspects on a big piece of paper. And then start working with all your configurations and squares and oppositions and, like, come to a place where you can unify and bring all this stuff together so it's working together so you're not fighting yourself. And of course, easy aspects, they just need lots of enhancement through creative visualization and the participatory approach because they can go bad on you real quick. And now we come to the lecture's topic. Mythic aspects. So each aspect evokes mythological stories common to all cultures. Mythic aspects can be formed through co-presence in the chart or through geometrical aspect. What I mean by co-presence is, just like I said, with your heart and your mind. They're both in here interacting, your heart and your mind. Mercury and Venus, Mercury and the moon are interacting no matter what the deal is in the chart. So it's important to understand the archetypal relationship. Well, same here. These mythic aspects we're about to talk about are important because if you have a relationship between Mercury and Venus, even if they're not an aspect, you will have a strong Mercury and a strong Venus in your chart. Like, let's say Gemini's rising, Mercury's a planet that governs the chart, Mercury's conjunct the moon, it's like really all over the chart, mercurial energy. Then you have Venus, like in Libra, conjunct the sun. So Libra, Venus, is really strong in the person too. Right there, you have these two mythic counterparts, Mercury and Venus, which creates this hermaphroditic female, which creates an Athena effect in the character. I've seen it many, 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 many charts. People walk in, and if they actually have Mercury in aspect to Venus, it's like really amplified. So you can look right at it and feel like you're standing next to Athena. I saw a girl in my class a month ago, and I looked at her, I was like, Athena? And I was like, what's your chart? And I was like, oh my God, Mercury conjunct Venus right there on the ascendant. And I was like, you're like the living embodiment of Athena. And then everybody in class is like looking at her going, you're right. I Googled Athena real quick and popped it up on the screen, images of Athena. And it looked like she was sitting there. She's like, I know what I'm being for Halloween. but anyway, Mercury Mars creates like a Hephaestus theme. Because you got this hermaphroditic male, you know, who like hangs out in the basement in the underworld, like working on magical items all day, and he's got his feet on backwards and he's all broken. He's like the clown of the gods, you know. But he was like amazing at building beauty, you know. And anybody has Mercury Mars real strong, they're natural MacGyvers, you know. They can like build a bomb out of toothpick. They're just like, I got this. And every time I meet a Mercury Mars person, I'm like, right when I see them, I'm trying to be like, are you good at crafting things? Do you have a craftsman workshop in your house? They're like, oh my god, I have a whole place. It's usually down in the basement or way out in the garage. One guy had Mercury conjunct Mars in Scorpio. He walked up to me at the conference and he looked like Hephaestus coming at me. And I was like, Hephaestus! His name was John, but the whole conference I called him Hephaestus every time I saw him. He's like, what up, Vulcan? But anyway, God of Fire, you know, Mars, Mercury. And the guy was a master craftsman. And he did alchemy. He made talismans. I was like, that's a perfect use of Mercury, Mars, and Scorpio. So anyway, all these things are woven in. We're just going to look at them. I'll pass this around to show you my derivations. So the sun and moon are the first ones, and that's the moral eye. Even Zeus had the answer to the moral eye, the face. You know, and Tyche, luck. Like, the part of fortune came from the sun, moon, and rising sun, right? Part of fortune isn't really about luck. It actually means what is bestowed upon you in life by the fates, you know. It could be good or bad, you know. So usually you look at the lot of fortune, you calculate it based on whether nocturnal or diurnal chart. You look at the sign it's in, whatever planet, classical planet, governs that sign, is the bestower of fate upon you. That planet's transit progression will be entirely fated. Mm. And not say something has to hit you, but like you will experience more fatedness. If your lot of fortune's in Libra, progress Venus is like extremely fated in terms of relationship dynamics who you're going to meet. In terms of like, whoa, that just changed my life. Those kind of like moments, you know? I always say, be careful. You look across the room, one set of eyes can change your life. So this establishes the Li of being, the sun-moon dynamic, the organic patterning, you know, the cracks in the jade. So sun-Mercury is Asclepius, Orpheus, and of course Hermes. So people that have a sun-Mercury strong, they have this Orpheus thing, they're like a really powerful musician or something. Jimi Hendrix had Mercury conjunct sun on the 12th house cusp. So you get this sort of Orpheus, Asclepius, this guy was like the god of healing, and he was he became that guy that holds the snake, you know, over you. The Asclepian temple in Greece. But when you go to a doctor in Greece, you would go up there, and you would be like, tell me a problem, and they'd make you like sit down and do some devotions, and then after a while, they let you in. And then you go in there, and you lay down on a bed, a marble, and there'd be soft stuff on it, and there'd be like a snake in the corner. Not like a bad snake's going to bite you, but like a symbolic snake is going to like suck the poisons out of you, or whatever. And then you would have a dream. In the morning, they would look at your chart. They would interpret your dream, and they'd be like, go to the temple of Athena and say 18 Hail Marys and light some incense. And you'd be good. You know, whatever the gods needed, they were going to get. You know? That's how you went to the doctor in the ancient world. You know? It still works today.
Why not?
It still works today. Have a dream. See what happens. If you get sick, have a dream. And ask the dream, why am I sick? And you will get answers. Sun Venus is Hebe. Hebe was the cupbearer of the gods before little Ganymede came along. And she was the goddess of youth, cupbearers, and forgiveness. So people that have Sun Venus, they have a beautiful essence about them. They have the Aphrodite, love, pleasure, beauty, procreation thing going on. Also the graces. You really feel the graces. The charities, which were cheer, thalia, joy, euphrosyne, and splendor. So people that have that Sun Venus, you can just feel these archetypes. So if you have Sun Venus, I would go to Wikipedia, type in Hebe, and read all about her. And figure out, like, wow, because it's not about you living that myth. It's about that myth replicating part of it into your life on all five dimensions of human expression. And understanding that that lives in you somewhere. That you are here. Your life purpose involves relationship and mastery of grace. And being a cupbearer and forgiveness. And so all these themes are really deep. Sun Mars was Aries and Orion. Mars Sun is like the male hunter. Orion has a great mythology, you know, but in Greek mythology, he sure went through a lot of like hammering. He got hammered a lot, you know. But also these embodiments of archetypes like victory and violent force, Via, Nike, that's where Nike stole the logo. These were like the winged guardians of Olympus that sit outside the gate. There were like four of them. Zeal was one of them, Zealous. So Sun Jupiter people are really expressed the Zeus archetype, but also Apollo. You know, the sun, Jupiter, Apollo was the son of Zeus, right? Jupiter means father of the sky. Pater, Zeus, God. So you got Apollo, Zeus. Apollo, the reason, I actually discovered all this because of somebody had an Apollo theme in their chart. My kid. I watched him grow up every day. And he built his own bow at the age of 3, and it worked.
Wow.
I was like, you're a natural archer. He started doing Reiki healing at the age of 2. People would come into the coffee shop and say, your kid just healed my headache in tears. I mean, like, he's such a great healer. And I was like, and then everything Apollo. His mom got remarried, had 5 more kids with her new husband, and Ariane became the caregiver to all the little ones. Mm-hmm. Another Apollo theme. Every single mythic theme that Apollo has was in my kid's chart. Mm-hmm. And I was like, where is this Apollo coming through? I'm like, it must be the sun Jupiter. You know, and then I started thinking, like, what's Mercury Venus? The hermaphroditic female. You know? And sun Saturn. Kronos. Atlas. That's why people with Sun Saturn feel like they're holding the weight of the world. Like that guy in the back over there. Kratos. That's where we get the word, you know, aristocrat. Kratos is power. Not one of those guardians of the gate, you know? But Sun Saturn is always also Geras. Geras. Fame and excellence in old age. He had this mythic, divine old guy walking around who was just all fame and excellence. You know, so people have Sun Saturn, they like do better in old age because they got Geras really strong in them, you know. Sun Saturn. Like my teacher told me, Kelly, your sun is square Saturn, it's 7 minutes of arc. It's like, don't rush it. Don't rush it. Just take your time. I'm like, you'll get better with age. I'm like, good. Here we go. Now I'm writing epic books on history. So, Moon. Ooh, here we go. So we got Moon Mercury is Hecate. All the Hecate was the lady of magic. She was one of the Titans who, like, sided with the Olympians. And as a result, she won doorways, keys to all the underworld, the sky, and the earth. So she was also like Mercury. So Hecate is Moon Mercury. When you take Moon, the goddess, and stick some Mercury in, magic and interpretation, you get Hecate. You also get Morpheus, dreams. The moon in the ancient world was dreams, you know. And Mercury was interpretation, communication coming through to a dream. So you get Morpheus, you get all these other ones, Iris. Oh, that's supposed to be Circe. I put the R in front of the wrong eye. Okay, and Medeus. So these are all like magic people, you know, Moon, Mercury. And you can still see that in the world there. Moon governs cooking. In when you cook, you're putting together a recipe to make a transformation happen in the food to make a magic effect, a taste. When you make a smoothie, you're making a potion, man. And when you're doing Mercury, you are writing. In 5000 BC, which was the midpoint of the age of Gemini, the Sumerians invented cuneiform writing. And the wheel. They're like, we're going to go somewhere, and we're going to write some stuff. And, you know, and so, during the age of Gemini, and also we're going to, and they invented beer, too. So now you got beer commercial, followed by car commercial, followed by words to get you to come to Target and buy something. So they know all about this, how power of words, you know. That's why they call it spelling. We're casting a spell. Because if you were like a wise man who could spell in the ancient world, you were like Gandalf. You were like a wizard. If the word duck was written there and you said duck, and everybody saw a duck in their head, they're like, ah! How does that work? So it was very mysterious writing, you know? And that's astrology. And now take that to astrology. The symbols and planets in the sky, they were like, dude, you're a magi. That's where the word magic comes from, the magistrate. They were priest kings. So, Moon Mercury. Mercury is about all that exchange instinct, and Moon is roots. And what is Cancer? Cancer is the archetype of roots instinct, homing, making a nest. Well, what is that as a cognitive form? It's the foundations of things, the principles of a field. That's what Cancer would be as a cognitive form, the deep foundations and principles. So this is like the principles of magic. When you got Moon Mercury, you got strong Hecate energy. And then you got Moon Venus, Hestia, heart. Architecture. Hestia, she was the devoted to the hearth, right? The people that have strong Moon Venus, they have a grace around their healing arts. Hygieia, health, cleanliness. Spell the cleanliness wrong again. Purification. Oh, and Astraeus, the dusk, and Eos, the dawn. Remember Eos? You know, He also is connected to Moon and Venus. It's always what's rising, what's setting. Astraeus, the dusk. And then you get Moon Mars. Moon Mars was Artemis. There was a girl in my class, goes to Naropa in Boulder, and she had Moon over here, and Mars over here, and they were in opposition, and there was an Aries theme, and I was like, dang, it's like Artemis up in here. She's like, who's that? I was like, Artemis was the huntress, goddess of the wild. She opposed Athena. Athena was all civilization and skill and crafts and all that. Artemis was the virgin huntress who was out there running around in the woods. And she was about the essence of wildness in nature. And she just froze and her mouth dropped open. She goes, I just finished my thesis for my master's degree. It's all about the wildness of nature. I was like, look at these myths. Like right there in their chart. Moon Mars. As soon as you see Moon Mars, you have a goddess who wants to hunt something. You know, Mars, you know. She is her own self, you know. And that's why she was the virgin goddess. Back then, a virgin wasn't someone who hadn't had sex. A virgin was a woman who herself didn't need a man to take care of her. So like most CEOs today would be virgins in the ancient world. The meaning would be like, I don't need no man to take care of me. So Inyo and Eris is Discord and Atalanta, the daughter of Hippolyta, Amazon queen, daughter of Ares. So you got that Atlanta. She's the one who runs the race with the golden apples. Hippolyta, Amazon queen, daughter of Ares. So you got a feminine version of Ares, you know, queen of the Amazons. So you got these beautiful myths. And I, like I said, they don't have to be in conjunction or opposition. When they are, they're even amplified more in their character. But when you have a situation where, like, they're Cancer rising and the moon is really strong, right? And then Mars is over there, like, conjunct the sun or on the midheaven, and you'll just, they don't even have to be an aspect. You will feel Artemis energy coming out of that person. Just looking at them, you'd be like, whoa. Moon Jupiter is Hera, right? You've got this goddess who's all about wall and the sacred rites of marriage, the Hieros Gamos, right? And she's always getting mad at Jupiter for like cheating on her stuff. And Horae, the hours, the seasons, Salo, Oxo, and Carpo. These are the seasons. The Greeks didn't have four seasons. They only had three seasons. There was no winter. They folded winter into a little bit of Carpo, a little bit of Salo. So it's blossom, growth, harvest, you know. So the hours and seasons. That's why we call it a horoscope. Horae means hour, scope means to view. And actually, horoscope should not be applied to sun signs. The ancient word horoscope meant the ascendant. The horoscopos was the view of the hour right now. So that was the name for the ascendant was horoscopos. So if you were calling the horoscope the sun sign, you're wrong. But Dyke, the moral order and customs, eunomia, order and governance. She would get mad at me for putting an extra parenthesis. Inside joke. Hesperides, the garden of the Hesperides, that was Hera's garden, you know. Peace, wealth, cornucopia.
Are you going to email this?
Yeah, this is all one PDF right here. So yeah, you can start working with these in charts. In the book, I actually go into the myths and how to use them. We're almost done.
Are we
trying to cut us off?
Yeah, I was just saying.
Okay, yeah, we're almost done here.
Okay.
So Moon Saturn, look, you got a goddess who is wise and old, Demeter, the Earth Mother. Da Mater means Earth Mother. And also Eileithyia is another one, midwifery. Sybil was actually the old Demeter before they had the Olympians. She was the old mountain mother. Sybil. So that's all Demeter. Demeter was Zeus's like older sister, you know. She came out first. And then of course you got Mercury. That's the Athena subflow. Wisdom, skill, and craft. Ganymede, youth. Medusa is the dark side of this, the hermaphrodite. Mercury and Venus actually got together and had a baby once and became this crazy creature, and everybody's like, y'all don't get together anymore. Mercury and Mars is the Hephaestus, smithing, crafting. Also the Dioscuri, which were Castor and Pollux, the twins. Pollux was the immortal twin. He was a master boxer, the Muhammad Ali. And Castor was the master of the horse. And then he died, and then Pollux got mad, and then Zeus took him in the heavens and immortalized him. Mercury, Jupiter, that would be Chiron. You got a centaur teacher who is like really smart and knows about herbalism and crafts and magic and can interpret things. And also Prometheus is there. The energy of Mercury, Jupiter. I mean, Prometheus stole Mercury, the god of thieves, the sacred flame of Jupiter, and then Jupiter and him have a whole history.
Mm.
Also, the nine muses come through here, Moussai, and the Animae, the four winds. You can go to Greece, in Athens, there's a tower of the four winds right there. The four winds, the zephyrs and all those. So they're all Mercury Jupiter. You get a bunch of wind going, like me up here, Saturn rising with my moon in Gemini, like Mercury Jupiter. I always loved Prometheus. Mercury Saturn, of course, is Faunus or Pan. You got this little tricky goat who's like little wise nature guy. Epimetheus would be the equivalent too. Epimetheus is the historian of the gods. When Mercury is setting behind the sun, that's Mercury's Epimetheus state. When it's rising ahead, it's Mercury Prometheus, more forward thinking, progressive, as opposed to let's see what the tradition is first and build slowly upon it. Tiresias was interesting. He's the blind seer. He used to walk around Greece and just knew all this stuff. He was like Mercury Saturn, you know? He was like a Gandalf, you know, a mercurial trickster figure who was very wise, you know? And Momus was the god of poetry, satire, and mockery. So you got communication happening on a mockery level. That's good Mercury Saturn there. Momus. And then Proteus was the old man of the sea, the shape-shifting again, you know? And then Saturn, in the old days, Capricorn and Saturn had to do with the goatfish man from ancient Babylonia. That's where we get the goatfish. Because Enki was the god of the underworld springs that would come up and teach the Sumerian civilization. And Aquarius was his seven students who were like the great man or the great one. And they were the seven sages, which are seen in the Big Dipper. And the Babylonian mythos. So all this Babylonian stuff and Egyptian stuff and Greek stuff is all together in the book. And then really quick, Venus and Mars, Eros and Psyche. You get desirous soul people at Venus, Mars. They got all this erotic energy. They got to learn how to channel that, you know? Venus, Jupiter, Dionysius. You got this guy that wants lots of pleasure, and he wants a lot of it. We're going off the deep end into wine and libations and madness and bliss. That's totally Venus, Jupiter, the Dionysian flow. And Andromeda and Cassiopeia, because Jupiter always brings up the highest, most paragon of something. And this is the paragon of the feminine, Venus. So the paragon of femininity. You see it in Cassiopeia and Andromeda. But you also see it in the male form, as Adonis. You walk in the coffee shop and you see those really like dressed really well guys that look like little Greek statues, you know? I saw this guy in the coffee shop once. He walked in, you can tell he's gay. I'm like, dude, you got Adonis all over you. Yeah, Venus, Jupiter. I look at the chart. There it is. Venus opposing Jupiter. And then I sat down with him and worked out his Venus, Jupiter opposition. But, so then Venus, Saturn would be core, you know? When a woman runs into some limitations, you got core being abducted, Persephone, Venus, Saturn. Or, you know, Ariadne in the labyrinths, past unrequited love, you know, Venus, Saturn. See, Ariadne loved Theseus. She helped him escape the labyrinth, and then he kind of left her on the island and dissed her. And she was like, what's up? Unrequited love, you know. You get that Saturn, Venus. So these can play out in transits, too. Mm-hmm. You know? So, but Persephone is definitely Venus, Saturn, you know, in terms of, like, the beautiful young maiden who has to, like, face this monster, Kronos of the underworld. So Mars, Jupiter is Hercules. This is the paragon of masculinity. All of Perseus, Odysseus, Heracles, Jason the Argonauts, any masculine going on a journey or a quest, this is the masculine on the quest instead of the feminine. Then Mars, Saturn would be the Hades, Tartarus. This would be Pluto in the ancient world. This is how they saw Pluto right here. Mm. Mars, Saturn, like that guy with a axe in his face. Like the Fury's got a hold of you, man. Chiron, the ferryman, Xanatos, Hypnos, Styx, Nemesis. All those rivers in the underworld were Mars, Saturn, and Typhon, the great serpent of the underworld that Apollo slew to get the Delphic oracle power, and Minos, which was the judge of the dead. And then the last one is Jupiter, Saturn, Poseidon, the earth shaker. When the earth shakes, Poseidon came, and Poseidon was seen as the embodiment as a bull. And he also governed horses. You know, you don't get a lot of this in modern astrology, but Poseidon was a definitely more about this cycle of the sea and the earth coming together, not just the sea. And then you got the Jupiter, Pisces, Saturn, the earth. So then Pan was the physician of the gods, and then before Chiron. And then Pontus was the actual embodiment, the myth of the sea. When you get Jupiter, you get that sort of Jupiter-Saturn, you get this grounded version of Jupiter. It becomes the air condenses into the water, and you get the sea. So it's like the water cycle, too. So anyway, that's it for tonight. Come on, please give me these back because I'm not done putting them all in the book yet. Cool. pleasure to Mormon.
Oh, wait a minute.
Okay.
No, it's not.
Thank you. Hope
you
enjoyed.
Yes.
My life. You want what happened?
That's true.
Oh, what can you do? Who's the guy?
I just wanted to say thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Much.
Thank
I
you.
Wish I could be here tomorrow. But I'll be waiting for you one hand for the email.
Yes,
right.
I'll email that.
Yes.
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 Who was the guy? I'm talking about some guy that.
So combine that with can we put it back in here?
Yeah.
See, this will give almost the same thing, you know, that's in there. But this is just a brief little, you know, few words, and that gives a beautiful cut. And the same thing with the signs. That's the important thing. See, and the signs are divided up into fire, air, and water groupings, and cardinal figures. That's not probably not a bad thing. Right now, figure out the meanings of signs and the meanings of plants and also the houses, because he was talking about that. See, now the houses are pie-shaped segments. This is the first house, this is the second house, this is the third house, this is the fourth, all the way around to the 12th. And those are different from the signs. See, the signs out here are Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces, Aries, like that. And so there's like two fields. I tell people who are beginner astrologers sometimes, to find an agent, like if you see a textbook in biology class, where they have a clear sheet of plastic that lays on top of something and go like that, and then drink the water, and there's another layer and it goes like that. Think of it like that, because this is the horizon. This is the eastern point of the horizon. This is the western. This is not north and south. This is up and down. In other words, this is not a map like this. This is a map like this. So when you were born, you were born at 3 in the morning, and the sun was down below your feet, because it was on the other side of Earth. It was dark. It was night. So imagine if you were a little man standing right in the center of you. If you look up, if you stood so you're facing south and your left hand was east, and if you look up there, you would see Pluto. If you looked up there, you would see Jupiter. If you looked up there, you would see Chiron. See, that's how this is like a map of the position of the planets across the sky. And of course, you can only see what's above the horizon, but there's the lower feet on the other side of the Earth, you know, is where all these things are. So the Earth rotates every 24 hours, of course. And you can imagine the signs of the zodiac up in the sky. And the way we measure them, I tell people, like, think about the, like a tape measure that goes down across the eastern horizon and then goes up across the sky and down on the western horizon. Okay, now if you're standing on a brilliant, clear summer night and a big grassy looking at the stars, you can see all these constellations, and it's really cool. But what happens if you stand there all night long, is all the stars, just like the sun rises and sets, all the stars are going like that across the sky. So if right on the eastern horizon is a constellation of Sagittarius, and a little bit above that is the constellation Scorpio, and a little bit above that is the constellation Libra. What's happening on a 24-hour basis is all of these are rotating like this. They're rising up. This is the eastern horizon. So if you were born at 6 a.m., the sun is such that the dot would be like right there. If you were born at 7:30, a little bit after sunrise, the sun would be here. If you were born at noon, the sun would be here. So think of this as like two separate wheels, you know, pinned at the center. And this one wheel with the planets in it is turning like this. So you can think of either way, that fix the planets like this and then take this outside tape measure, you know, and spin it like this, or hold this fixed and take all these and spin it like that. The point is there's a relative motion. And divide 24 hours by, or one day by 360 degrees by 24 hours.
I have to go. I'm going to help clear the road.
60 degrees by
an hour.
This changes 1 degree every 4 minutes. In other words, if you were born this would not change 2 degrees.
Where am I? Am I in Tarjay?
So the planets are all fixed in the signs. You know, the sun changes slowly. It goes all the way around every year on a few hours or a one-day basis. The sun's still going to be pretty close there. And likewise, all of the other planets. But this out here changes, you know, 1 degree every 4 minutes. So there's like two layers. This happened because your rising sun is 2 degrees. Dividing line for your first house is really close to the dividing line here between Sagittarius and Capricorn. But sometimes it's like more like 15 degrees or something. I tell people, imagine that this is two layers of pie slices. One is the houses, which is this here. And another one is the signs. So you can take the center point of the circle, take a ruler, and draw a line like that, and that segment is the sign of Capricorn. But if we did that, then we'd have all these lines here, and it would be really messy to do this. It's already pretty complicated. So the simplest thing is to just show the houses, and then you have a ring out there to show where the signs are. So and what's called the natural zodiac starts with Aries, the beginning of all buildings here. So Aries is kind of associated with the first house, and Taurus is kind of associated with the second house, so on and so forth. So when you read in this, well, actually, you could read on this, where it says the houses. Hold that for a second. I'm trying to find it out here. Which is significant.
Okay, cool. One truck.
So anyway, you can kind of study this, and you can look at this and you can say, okay, my moon is in my seventh house. And it's in the sign of Cancer. You don't recognize that as a symbol of you. And you can look over here and find Cancer and see what characteristics Cancer has. And it shows that the moon, which symbolizes the emotions. So if you're like, well, okay, that's the moon, but what does the moon mean? Well, then you go to this, the planets, and here's a description of the sun, and here's a description of the moon, so you can read what this represents. The moon represents the personality, the subconscious, or subjective mind, instinctive, and so on and so forth.
My moon is in Cancer.
Yes, your moon is in Cancer.
Okay.
So, and your sun is Pisces.
Do you enjoy
your ascendant or your rising sun?
I pretty much live in the dark.
No, that's
an
ascendant. Okay, so
what's my chart?
Of these four things,
February 5th.
Angles, the ascendant is this one, 2 degrees Capricorn. The descendant here, yes, is the opposite. It's 2 degrees of Cancer. The midheaven is the MC. It's this one here. And then the IC, the computer software didn't print it out exactly, but it's exactly the opposite of the MC. Just like the ascendant and descendant are 180 degrees apart. So the IC is at 24 degrees and 5 minutes of Aries, the sign that's opposite the sign of Libra. So the angles are like the four angles of the chart like that. This actually, this is a slightly different one here. This is essentially the same thing, but this is coke houses, and this one is equal houses. But in this case, this is the MC, and this is the IC. So let me...
Thank you.
Goodbye, Kelly! Thank you. See you tomorrow, hopefully.
Bye, sweetie.
I'm going to put...
I'll go home and go to sleep.
MC. Right there.
Okay. I'm going to let my third wind. I'll have it like a little nap today.
So when you're looking at this, you can go, okay, MC and IC, where are they? Okay, so that line is the MC, and that line is the IC.